Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise. I'm your host, David Price. We have a quite a packed episode for you this time around. You're going to hear from Pat. You're going to get a Smash Tales. You're going to get another Moon Knight episode. And I think you're going to hear from Steve with some thoughts on an Iron Fist Marvel Masterworks. That, I think, is what we're going to start with. We're going to kick all of that off. I'll be back later. I am back this week. I want to thank Steve for pitching in a couple weeks ago, and of course, for the preview episode. He and Kevin doing a bang-up job, as usual. But I was missed. I'll talk to you guys in a bit, and enjoy the show.
How's it going, everyone? Pat Loika here, and you're listening to Pat's Picks for this week, August 24th, 2011. Of course, I'm going off of a list that is tentative, so just a heads up, some of the stuff that I'm gonna mention may not actually arrive at your stores this week. Because that is the nature of the beast, unfortunately. At any rate, let us go and go through this list. I will be going in alphabetical order, as it'll probably be the easiest way to go, and then I will go through and revisit my picks of the week at that point. First of all, there's Captain America and Bucky number 621 by Ed Brubaker, Mark Andreyko, and Chris Somney. This is a retelling, well, not really a retelling, because we never really saw the actual event happen, the actual story happen, but this is the very first mission of Cap and Bucky together, and it looks like a very interesting book. Of course, it's got a great creative team. I mean, you can't go wrong with Ed, you can't go wrong with Mark, and especially not with Chris Somney involved, and this should be something that anyone can get into. So, Captain America and Bucky number 621. Go look for it. It's $2.99. On the same note, the final volume of Captain America, featuring Bucky as Cap, ships this week. It's called, of course, it's the Captain America, the Cold War premiere hardcover, and this is, of course, you know, the follow-up to the trial of Captain America. Bucky sent to a Russian gulag in this one, and of course, he has to survive while Steve tries to figure out what's going on. Some gorgeous art by Butch Geis and Chris Somney in this book. Of course, it's written by Ed Brubaker, so you have that definite stamp of quality. This collects Captain America number 616 to 619, and it's a $24.99 price point, which some may say is unfortunate, but I think it's worth it for the great stuff that's contained within. Of course, you could always get this cheaper if you look at the right places, like InStockTrades.com or on Amazon, or, of course, friends over at CheapGraphicNovels.com. Then there's Fear Itself, Youth and Revolt number 4, probably one of the standout tie-in books from Fear Itself. It features, of course, Sean McKeever and Mike Norton reunited, doing Gravity stories again, and, of course, there's the other characters, too, but come on, you know you're there for Sean and Mike because they're doing Gravity again. Another phenomenal book that it's worth checking out, and of course, with a creative team like that, how can you say no, right? Next up, of course, is one of my favorite books, FF, Issue 8, by Jonathan Hickman and Steve Epting, I believe, is doing the issue this time around, and we get to the War of Four Cities. They've been building this up for the last few issues now, the machinations of all the Reeds finally coming to fruition here, and of course we've seen the return of Black Bolt. This is all tying together, and I can't wait to see how Jonathan Hickman ties it all up, really. This should be a lot of fun, and of course, with a great creative team like that, and it's such a fun concept, fun story, I don't think you can go wrong with this FF. Speaking of which, another FF thing comes out this week, and it's the first premiere hardcover collecting the first 5 issues with John Hickman, Steve Epting, Barry Kitson, of course, Paul Mount. The first 5 issues of this book is finally collected in premiere hardcover. If you missed out, this is your chance to catch up. And again, one of my favorite books, so you can't really... There is no failing when it comes to FF, you know. This is good stuff. Then there is, of course, the final issue of Greg Pak's amazing run on the Hulk, Incredible Hulk 635. It's the final chapter of Heart of the Monster. And you know, Greg Pak and Paul Pelletier are together doing this issue. It should be great. I am going to miss Greg on the Hulk, actually, because I think he is he has become the definitive Hulk writer of the last, I would say, in the last 10 years, because no one really stuck on board. And, you know, there was a run by that by Bruce Joseph that people were really really divided about. But for the most part, everyone loved Greg Pak's run. And I think he did a really good job, you know, charting the story, you know, the story of Bruce Banner and, of course, everyone around him. I'll miss Greg on this book, but he still has his presence in the Marvel Universe, and it should be interesting to see where the Hulk goes from here when Jason Aaron and Mark Silvestri take over. Next up is The Mighty Thor number 5, Thor versus the Silver Surfer on the Surface of Mars, written by Matt Fraction and, of course, illustrated by Olivier Coppel, colored by Laura Martin, and, of course, inked by Mark Morales. This is an all-star team that you just can't go wrong with. So I buy on the name, on that name alone, really, on those names alone. Then there's Punisher number 2, Greg Rucka, Marco Cicchetto. Amazing book. Great debut issue from them last month. I think they're going to continue on with this. I mean, I did have a bit of an issue with the detectives from 7 making a cameo, but I think, yeah, but that's pretty negligible. This has been, the first issue has been great so far, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what they do with the rest of the storyline. There's also a few other books coming out here that there are a couple other books that I'm super excited about. That's Ultimate Comics, Ultimates. Was that enough Ultimate for you? Also by Jonathan Hickman. And this is illustrated by Esad Rimik and colored by one of my favorites, Dean White. It's a new era for the Ultimates. Finally, a writer on this book that I can really get behind. And I'm not really going to say anything else about previous writers on Ultimates, but it's nice to see that we're going to kind of do something with the Ultimates again that looks like it's going to be a good direction for those characters and that title. So I look forward to it. And of course, I love Esad Rebic's work, and I'm a big fan of colorist Dean White, which I've mentioned many times before. And finally, my pick of the week, Uncanny X-Force number 13. It's the last chapter of the not really last chapter. It's part 3 of the Dark Angel saga. The most of Uncanny X-Force is stuck in the Age of Apocalypse. The Dark Beast has abandoned them and turned on and double-crossed them, which is what we expected them to do because he's the Dark Beast. And things just go bad from this point on. I don't want to ruin anything. Of course, gorgeous cover by Esad Rimik. And this is illustrated by Jerome Opeña, written by Rick Remender, and of course, colored by, again, one of my favorites, Dean White. I think this is like his big week, Dean White. You can't go wrong with this book. This is probably the best X title that's out there right now, and I sure hope everyone's reading it because it is quite great. Check it out. It's great. So, pick of the week, once again, Uncanny X-Force number 13. As far as the collected editions, though, I don't really have a pick of the week that stands up, but I guess I will go with FF because that's the one that I really want more people to check out. So, FF, Volume 1. Try and find the, as much as I like the Steve Epting cover, I like the Daniel Acuña variant cover for that. And I think it just pops. It's gorgeous, it's pretty, it's very bright, very fun, very fun, actually. So, look for the Acuña variant cover because I think you'll get a kick out of that. It shows all of the FF in one really happy picture. And that's it for me this week. It's nice to be back here. Again, I keep promising to come back, but I keep failing to deliver on my end because, well, things just happen sometimes. But I'm pretty sure I'll be staying on board, and I'll be having some I'll be weighing in every other week whenever a new episode drops. So you can expect me and my picks every week, or every episode, rather. If you're looking for more information on me, you want to see my stuff, you can go to about.me/PatLoika, and you can get to all my social networks and a link to my own show, which is Loika Mania. So until next episode, you guys take it easy, take care, and keep reading your comics.
The more he struggles, the more Bruce Banner triggers the strange gamma rays within his straining body until...
Rick in danger!
How has it come to this, Smash fans? We are facing a crisis of epic proportions here in the Smash Cave, what with the Smash team still on strike, and now those NFL players who were pitching in around here all gone back to work. Well, sure, the Colonel and I still know how to press the record button, but do you have any idea the hardships we've had to endure? Where are the catered meals?
Who will give me my post-show massage?
Do any of you realize that I haven't had a decent pedicure in over 5 weeks?
And yet, for the sake of all you listeners, we shall carry on.
When the names of those with great determination and inner strength are whispered, Gandhi, Chuck Norris, Neo, the names Rick Hansen and Colonel Mooseblood will be among them.
Sure.
Speaking of us, we too are your hosts for the Titanic Tales, highlighting the adventures of the Incredible Hulk. If you are new to Smash Tales, welcome! The Colonel and I are pleased to offer up our best impressions of the Hulk and his gang of misfits. In our last episode, we saw Doc Samson go toe-to-toe with the rampaging Hulk, who was separated from Bruce Banner several issues back, and is now tearing a swath across the New Mexico desert. Determined to destroy the Hulk before he can add more lives to his rampage, Samson failed to score a win against the Green Goliath before the Hulk leapt away from the battle site. After finding and destroying the practice robot of the newly formed Hulkbusters, Doc Samson ended up fighting for his life against said team, who assaulted Samson with weaponry designed by Bruce Banner himself. While the battle resulted in the unintentional demise of one of the Hulkbusters, Carolyn Parmenter, Bruce Banner summoned up all his courage to pop the question to the love of his life, Betty Ross. And what do you know? She said yes!
This story takes place across 2 issues of The Incredible Hulk. First titled 319, Member of the Wedding, sold for 75 cents featuring the writing, penciling, and inking of John Byrne, background inks from Keith Williams, letters by Rick Parker, colors by Andy Yuckas, and edited by Danny O'Neill. Issue 320, titled Honeymoon's Over, also sold for 75 cents and is a story written by Al Milgram, with art by Milgram and Del Barras, letters by Rick Parker, colors by Andy Yuckas, and edited by Bob Harris. And after today's story, stay tuned for not only the usual bullpen bulletins of Green Mail, but also a special feature from the Hulkophile Gary M. Miller on the departure of John Byrne from the pages of the Hulk.
Well, despite the hardships of being understaffed, the adventures of Hulk the Incredible go on must. Oh man, this is gonna go so well.
This is Smash Tale!
Doc!
A young man with a backpack appears in the hallway inside Gamma Base, arms open, with an enormous smile on his face.
I don't believe it. Rick! Rick Jones! It's good to see you, lad. Wonderful, in fact. But how in the world did you get past the security perimeter?
Hey, Doc, come on now. If I wasn't good at slipping through security nets, you and I would have never met in the first place, right?
It's been a long time, Rick.
Ain't that the truth? Good to see you again, Betty.
Rick, what could possibly have brought you back here after all these years?
Are you kidding, Doc? I heard you two are finally gonna tie the knot. Wild horses couldn't have kept me away.
Thanks, Rick. That means a lot. It's only fitting that we share some of the good times. Lord knows we've shared enough of the bad.
Hey, Doc, how could I stay away? Most of those bad times would have never happened had you not risked your life to save my stupid hide. If it wasn't for me, you would have never become the Hulk.
Don't say that, Rick. What happened, happened. You're not to blame. If fault lies with anyone, it's me, for building the Gamma Bomb in the first place.
Maybe. But if I hadn't gotten involved, you'd only be the inventor of a very nasty weapon, not a man who turns into a monster.
Be that as it may, you've spent most of the years since making up for it. You stood by the Hulk longer than anyone else. You fought at the side of Captain America, shared a strange dual existence with the alien Captain Mar-Vell, and have spent the last months in some form of loose association with the Space Knight Rom. We've all made mistakes in our time, Rick, but when it's all said and done, it was your friendship in those early days that helped keep me sane.
Thanks, Doc. A guy never had a better pal than you.
In any case, I'm not the Hulk anymore. It's now my task to destroy my former alter ego. But first, there are more important things to do. There's a wedding to attend to.
Now you're talking, Doc.
Meanwhile, off in the New Mexico deserts, we come upon a bizarre scene that defies explanation, although we're gonna try. The mindless Incredible Hulk, now a separate entity since being separated from Bruce Banner, stands facing two mechanical beings. One, the newest form of the Hulkbuster armor worn by Mr. Craig Saunders. The other, what looks like a ship from outer space hovering above the scorched earth. Both of them are armed to the teeth with cutting-edge weaponry, and the built-up tension is suddenly broken.
Okay, Creep, your hash is crashed.
The armored Hulkbuster fires both of its arm cannons. Yet the Incredible Hulk leaps right out of the way.
Rocky, he's breaking right. Nail him, nail him.
I'll do the best that I can, Saunders, but once the Hulk gets it in his head to leave a place, it's not a great deal we Hulkbusters can do. Except maybe blowing a large hole through his nasty green hide.
Firing multiple successive beams toward his prey, Samuel Larroquette rains down a volley of destructive energy that the Hulk barely dodges to his left, and then his right. And that's when the Hulkbuster has the Jade Giant right where he wants him. Off balance and unable to dodge a third time, the Hulk gets blasted with the beam's full force.
Rocky, pull back! He's flexing his leg muscles like he's gonna...
Yeah! He's gotta rip the ship to pieces!
In retaliation for the attack, the Hulk leaps toward the hovering ship, lands onto its hull, and punches his fist straight through to the cockpit!
I've got to do something! Gotta try to shake him off! It isn't working! Saunders, help me!
Get closer to me, I can't get a clear shot!
I can't maneuver any closer than this, Saunders, and the Hulk's weight and bulk are wrecking the aerodynamics of this ship! Hit him now!
Okay. Try to hold him steady for just 1 second so I can't! Rocky, I can't take the risk. But if I miss, I can hit the ship. You'd be killed. Just like Carolyn.
Carolyn? You can't blame yourself for that, man. It was Samson. Now do something, now!
The craft circles and dances in the sky directly above Saunders. Each time he takes aim, Larroquette jerks the ship in a new direction to keep the Hulk from reaching him inside the cockpit. The armored man makes move after move to help his partner, but his self-doubt causes him to hesitate every time he gets in range of blasting the Hulk. When suddenly, from behind...
Dun, dun, dun.
Well, if you're just gonna stand there like an armor-plated lump, Saunders, I guess you won't mind if I do something.
Samson!
That's Doc Samson to you, friend. And in case you've forgotten, I staked a claim on the Hulk's hide.
Doc Samson shoves the armored Hulkbuster to one side, leaps up to the flailing ship, and nails the Hulk with a left hook. Immediately, Doc Samson follows up with a right cross and then a double-fisted haymaker that sends the Hulk flying from the ship and crashing into the ground below.
He's down! This may be the only opportunity to chance to put him away permanent.
Saunders races to the crash site and fires his cannon at point-blank range at the Hulk.
I got him off balance. If only I can...
No!
The green Goliath brings two massive fists down and pounds the ground. bringing the rocky earth underneath Saunders up in a shockwave that sends him careening into the air.
Saunders, you fool! You're not allowing for the Hulk's native cunning. Even mindless, he's more than a match for you.
But you're not.
Without warning, the distracted Doc Samson is pounded from behind as Lauerkett discharges his weapon directly at the gamma-powered psychiatrist.
You interfere too often, Samson. You killed the woman I cared for, and now you're gonna pay with your own miserable life.
Blast it all, Lauerkett. That woman's death was not my fault. It was Saunders' over-eagerness that... Ah! No good, Samson. If you had an intruder during our training run, Carolyn would still be alive today. Now I'm going to... Huh? The Hulk!
From out of nowhere, the mightiest leg muscles on the face of the Earth propel the Jade Giant like a rocket straight at the Hulkbuster craft, and he strikes it full force, tearing a hole open in the side. Meanwhile, back at Gamma Base.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to join this man and this woman in the bonds of matrimony. Bruce and Betty, having found each other at last, after so many years apart, have come before us to join in this most honored union, a condition not to be entered into lightly. Therefore, they do call upon us as friends and trusted family to bear witness to the vows they are here to exchange. Do you, Bruce Banner, take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife, to have and to hold in sickness and in health, and forsaking all others, cleave you only unto her?
I do.
And do you, Betty Ross, take this man to be your lawfully wedded husband, to love, honor, and cherish, as long as you both shall live?
I do.
The ring, please. If there is anyone here who knows any reason why this man and this woman should not now be joined in the bonds of matrimony, let him speak now, or forever hold his peace.
Stop!
All faces in the wedding party turn their heads around in shock as the voice from behind is accompanied by a loaded handgun pointed directly at them. Back at the battlefield, the Hulk has ripped open the hull of the flying craft and is bearing down upon a helpless Sam Lauerkett.
Samson, my systems are damaged, out of commission. I can't help him. You gotta do something.
Me? You want me to go save him from the Hulk so we can start taking shots at me again? No, thank you, Saunders. I'm done here. You guys can have the Hulk all yourself. And after these messages...
We'll be right back!
An Atlas body in 7 days!
Dynamic tension starts giving you results that you can feel and your friends will notice. Big, useful muscles. Gain weight if needed. Lose pot belly if needed. Send name and address for a 32-page book.
Trials Atlas.
Fearing Cobra Commander no longer has the ability to lead, Destro and Dr. Mindbender comb the tombs of the most evil leaders in history, and from their genetic tissues produce a composite clone with the military genius of Napoleon, the ruthlessness of Julius Caesar, the daring of Hannibal, and the cunning of Attila the Hun. Behold the ultimate Cobra Emperor, Serpentor.
Serpentor, the most evil one, G.I. Joe, G.I. Joe.
What happens next? Find out in Marvel Comics.
Tuesday, a night at the ballet gives Tony a dose of culture.
Hey, watch out, Barista Kov. Here comes Masilikov.
It's dance class detente.
What in Moscow?
With a Russian accent.
I even kissed him on both cheeks. Ooh.
Who's the boss? Then, how do you improve the perfect family?
Can you give me one real reason why we shouldn't have another child?
Wait here.
All it takes is a little love and, of course, growing pain.
Tuesday.
Return to the Transformers.
With the Incredible Hulk ready to take out all of his mindless fury on the puny human within the Hulkbuster flying vehicle, Doc Samson has refused to provide aid of any kind to the man who was trying to kill him mere moments ago.
But you gotta help him, Samson. You're the only one who can. I've gotta? I don't think so, Saunders. Lauerkett has made his bed. I'm quite prepared to let him lie in it. Samson, don't talk that way. You're supposed to be some kind of superhero. You just ain't going after the Hulk for the fun of it. You got responsibilities. You're the one who let the Hulk loose. Y'all said that y'all's gonna be the one to stop the monster.
Just cause y'all don't get along with Lara Kent ain't no reason to let the Hulk add another life to his tally. Less than y'all really what Rocky says you are. Blast you, Saunders. You make it very hard to be unreasonable. Very well. What's more onto the breach?
Doc Samson gets a running start and leaps toward the beast,
Corn,
plowing his foot directly into the Hulk's gut, forcibly separating him from the craft. Meanwhile, back at Gamma Base, an older man garbed in only an army coat with white hair and a mustache shakily aims a handgun at the wedding party.
Don't anyone even move so much as breathe, except for you, Banner. You move. Move away from my daughter.
General Ross, I...
Don't call me General Chaplain. I'm not worried of that title anymore. I'm disgraced. My rank. My uniform. I will let my only child make this horrible mistake. Now step away, Banner.
No, you don't, Thunderbolt.
No, punk kid, you were always more trouble than you were worth.
Rick Jones had snuck around to the side of the chapel where Ross was focused on Bruce and his daughter, hoping to get the drop on the old man. But Ross's military training kicks in and he whips the gun around, shooting Rick Jones in the stomach from only a few feet away.
No, Rick! You stupid, miserable, interfering old coot.
Betty, how dare you speak to me like that? I am your father.
My father? You can still call yourself that after all that's happened between us? You're not my father. A father is someone who loves and cares, and laughs, and cries. A father is a friend and a counselor. You were never anything other than a tyrant.
Now you see here, young lady.
No, you see here. After all I've done is listen to you, follow your orders. Well, that's done. Over. I'm not your young lady anymore. I'm a woman and I'm gonna have my own life.
Betty, I'm not finished.
You loomed over me my entire life. Dominated me, told me how to think, how to feel. You never let me have a moment where I could call my own. And then I met Bruce. He showed me that men weren't all like you. He showed me that men could have a tender side, a sweet, shy, loving side. But you mocked him for it. You called him a milksop. You raged at my glowing love for him. You did everything in your power to stand in our way, kill our love. And now you're doing it again. Well, there's only one way you'll succeed this time. You're gonna have to kill me!
Betty grabs a hold of her father's wrist and brings his handgun right to her chest.
Well, Mr. War Hero, Mr. Take Command, what are you gonna do? What are you gonna do?
Betty, please. I never knew. I never understood.
Of course not. You never wanted to.
Thunderbolt Ross lets the gun slide from his hand as he slumps down to his knees.
I only wanted to make you happy.
Meanwhile, the battle in the desert rages on. The upper hand Doc Samson seemed to have had has faded away as the Hulk's anger and strength now absorb all of Samson's punches. And when the Hulk picks him up and throws Samson through the front doors of an abandoned church, he crashes through layers and layers of dried wood, finding himself buried in a pile of old church pews.
He's gone. He's just took off like he lost interest as soon as Samson was off him.
Of course. Mindless as he is now, the Hulk has no concentration span. As soon as something's out of his sight, he forgets it. Literally. But what about Samson?
Lowercat rushes over to the old church, straight toward the rubble where they last saw Doc Samson buried.
There's no sign of life here. My God, if he's been killed after he risked his life to save me. Samson! Samson, where are...
Suddenly a fist erupts from the rubble, knocking Lowercat on his back, where Saunders runs over to join him.
Don't come playing all this concern over me, Lowercat. I saved your hide because I had to, not because I wanted to. Now, I'm going to say this one more time. The Hulk is mine! You tell Bruce Banner to keep his hired goons out of my way. If he doesn't, I'll make his life with the Hulk seem like a picnic by comparison.
Back at Gamma Base.
Rick's in pretty bad shape. No one can take a .45 slug at that range and laugh it off. I've done what I can for him, but he needs a real doctor. We've got to get him to a hospital right away.
No. Don't stop the ceremony on account of me. I can hold on for a few more minutes without a doc.
Rick, don't be foolish. You'll bleed to death.
Don't argue, Betty. Too many things have screwed up you guys before. I'm not gonna add to them. Come on, Padre. Get these crazy kids hitched.
Okay, Reverend. Rick's right. There are only a few words left to be said.
Let's get them said, then.
Yes, very well. Then, by giving and receiving of rings, let this act of union be sanctified. And by the power vested in me by the state of New Mexico, I now pronounce you husband and wife. You may kiss the bride.
And as Hideko Takada helps prop up the injured best man, and despite the presence of a disgraced and defeated father, a woman who is no longer Betty Ross, but Betty Banner, kisses her husband, and they enjoy their first moments together, Bruce and Betty, married at last!
Hooray!
Voltron will be back after these messages.
Oh dear, R2, what did he call us into now?
Coming from Marvel Comics and Star Comics, Star Wars Droids.
The adventures of C-3PO and R2-D2 from Star Wars and their hit Saturday TV show. Now in their very own Star Comics series!
Droids are copyright. Lucasfilm Limited. Marvel Comics Group.
Hi, time for Timer. And time to make a week's supply of healthy after-school snacks. Now some weekend when it's raining and your mother is complaining because you're hanging around just twiddling your thumbs. Tell your mom that you've been itching to make something in the kitchen. And oh yes, the mess will be a minimum. But the thing that's going to please her is you make it in the freezer, and nothing could be easier to fix. Now just watch as I go through it. Really, all you need to do it is some kind of juice and just a few toothpicks. Okay, now take an empty ice tray and fill it up with orange juice or lemonade or pomegranate juice or whatever turns you on. Then cover the tray with plastic wrap, carefully poke the toothpicks through the plastic, put it in the freezer, and in a few hours, presto, stacks of snacks. Don't wait until it rains before you try this nifty trick. You'll have a fun time eating sunshine on a stick.
They're like millions of them, Summer Fox. What are we gonna do?
Don't worry, Solar Fox, the new video game where speed and strategy are all you have to fly through 26 changing solar fields. And if you're really fast,
awesome,
you'll skip ahead to even tougher fields.
Really cool.
Solar Fox from CBS Electronics.
Can I drive now?
Where the excitement never ends.
Hey there, everybody. Have you always wanted to know everything there is to know about the Incredible Hulk, but just don't have time to read comics? Well, you're in luck, because the Incredible Hulk cast is coming to you every month with all the latest news and reviews of the Incredible Hulk comics. We've got the Green Hulk.
The Red Hulk.
The Green She-Hulk.
The other Green She-Hulk.
The illegitimate children of the Hulk.
Yeah, all of them.
The Red She-Hulk.
Her too.
Even a blue guy who kind of is a Hulk.
Yeah, I suppose.
Listen to the Incredible Hulk cast each and every month only on the Deliberate Noise Network.
Now return to the Amazing Spider-Man and the Incredible Hulk.
A few days later.
Give me one good reason why not, Bruce.
I can give you 100 good reasons, Betty darling.
I don't need 100. Give me one. Just one good reason why we can't go on a honeymoon. I mean, look at us. Together at long last, after the Hulk kept us apart for so many years, newly married and yet living on a paramilitary base and dressing up like so many toy soldiers, I need a real life.
Laura kept a Hulkbuster base. You there, Banner?
Right here, Samuel.
Well, this new buggy of yours is working out just fine. Hails the terrain, no sweat. I just hope the armaments are as strong as you say.
They are.
Yeah, well, it doesn't look like we'll get a chance to test them anytime soon. There's no sign of the Hulk in any direction so far as our instruments can tell. Lara kept signing off.
You see, Bruce, now there's our chance. I booked us a passage on a luxury liner that's scheduled to leave San Francisco late this afternoon. Surely you're entitled to work a week off after the years you spent chained to that monster.
I just don't know, Betty. The Hulkbusters may be alright while I'm gone, but what about Rick?
What about Rick? He's recovering nicely from his bullet wound. If he seems okay when we visit the hospital today, we'll go on a honeymoon. Agreed?
Well...
Forget the Hulk, Bruce. Or at least try. Even if your Hulkbusters don't find him, Don't forget that Doc Samson has been tracking him, too.
And with that, we turn to the near lifeless patch of land we've come to know as the New Mexico Desert, where Doc Samson is still engaged in his crusade to put the Hulk down for good.
Log entry 208. After 6 days of fruitless searching, the Hulk's trail is heating up. I just passed a car smashed on a deserted stretch of highway, followed by a shattered bus. The Hulk must be nearby. I can only hope. There! He's just on the edge of Jericho. I've got to stop him now before he gets too far, or else there's no telling how many lives will be lost.
Doc Samson's carefully measured leaps have been to cover as much ground as possible over the last week, but now he isn't going for distance, but for maximum velocity, and thus the leather-clad superhero hits the Hulk from behind with a thunderous impact. Further out in the desert.
What do you say, Hulkbusters? Should we call it quits for today?
That sounds agreeable, Saunderson.
Hold it, people. Let's at least make one more visual sweep of the area. For crying out loud, Rocky, give it a rest, will ya? Y'all become a blast of fanatic since Carolyn died.
Fanatic, eh, Saunders? Well, just look at that tower over there. There's smoke. And I'm willing to bet where there's smoke, there's the Hulk setting things on fire.
Meanwhile, over at La Paloma Medical Center, Bruce and Betty Banner are checking up on an old friend and his new wounds.
Glad to see you're looking so well, Rick. I guess I ain't so bad for a guy who just took a 45 slug in the gut. I gotta tell you, Betty, I knew your father, Thunderbolt Ross, could be a bit of a loony sometimes, but I never expected him to try to break up your wedding by shooting me in the gut. This may be the first time that there was a shotgun wedding where the father of the bride was trying to stop the proceedings.
Excuse me for barging in like this, but I heard you were in the hospital, Bruce. I understand congratulations are in order.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Fisher.
As long as you're here, I wonder if I could examine you, Bruce.
Sure thing.
A few moments later, in a nearby examination room.
You say you've been having no ill effects from being separated from the Hulk, nor from my psychostimulation drug.
Well, I have been feeling rather tired. My brain a bit foggy, but I think that's only to be expected considering all I've been through.
Let me get a blood sample.
Betty's been pushing me to go on a honeymoon, but somehow I just can't seem to decide if the timing is right. What with the Hulk still on the loose and all.
Well, if you're looking for a medical opinion, I say go. A trip would do you a whole world of good, especially if it'll take your mind off all the problems your Hulk persona has caused you.
While Bruce Banner fights against everyone who is trying to get him to relax, another battle rages on just outside Jericho, a small town in New Mexico. Doc Samson has been successful at maneuvering the Hulk away from the populated area, but there is no sign his advantage will last any longer than his earlier encounters with the Green Goliath. When suddenly...
Wahoo! Great shot, Hideko! The Hulkbusters are here!
Thank you, Saunderson!
What? Not those meddlers again. And if it wasn't bad enough just battling the Hulk, I've got those bumblers underfoot again. Only one thing I can do. Try to end this early, before they get close enough to muck things up.
Doc Samson propels himself toward the Hulk with a full-scale attack, and a news crew has appeared to broadcast the battles of the nation at large. The broadcast catches the attention of not just idle home dwellers, but also the mighty Avengers, both viewing from the East Coast at New York City and on the West Coast on the outskirts of Los Angeles. A communication channel opens between the leaders of these two groups.
Yes, Iron Man, I've got the monitor tuned in to the local network.
Good, Wasp. I'm afraid Samson hasn't managed to best the Hulk as he claimed he could. And now...
There are people in danger. Yes, I see. I suppose we haven't any real choice, then.
We gave him his chance. I told him that if he didn't deal with the problem quickly, the Avengers would be back in full force. So be it. Avengers assemble!
Blast that sucker!
The battle between Doc Samson and the Hulk has been joined by the Hulkbusters, and in dramatic fashion, they sneak up behind the Hulk and blast him at point-blank range from their new vehicle. Doc Samson sees the effect the weapon has on the Hulk and hits the Hulk with everything he's got. The Hulk instantly recovers and pounds Samson down to the ground.
Use the grapplers. Keep on top of him. Give Samson a chance. You got it, Lara Kett. We got the Hulk.
Laser-honed, high-tensile, cobalt-steel arms reach out from the vehicle and clasp the Hulk in their icy grip. But they pose little challenge for the Green Goliath, who shreds them like confetti in his mighty hands. But then, the Hulk determines that it is not the arms which deserve his wrath, but the vehicle from which they sprang.
Abandon the vehicle! Get out of here!
Move! I'll keep them off your backs!
Doc Samson rushes headlong to the Hulkbuster vehicle, and while the Hulk is turning it into wreckage, gets him to focus on fighting rather than smashing. However, he quickly begins to regret this decision as the Hulk begins using Samson as a plaything, hurling him into the twisted steel and beating him into oblivion.
Losing consciousness, self-narration, overtaking, must keep fighting.
Once Samson ceases to fight back, the Hulk begins tearing into the Hulkbuster vehicle again, pulling apart tons of metal and throwing huge chunks up into the air.
He scrapped us, but now it looks like he forgot all about us.
Consider yourself fortunate, monsieur. Has anyone seen Madame Hideko?
I thought I saw her jump clear. More to the bloody point, where the Hades is Banner? He got us in this little Donnybrook. Why isn't he here to bail us out?
Meanwhile, on a cruise ship, now far outside San Francisco Bay.
I can't remember when I've known such peace, Betty. Now I feel sure I can shake this physical malaise I've been feeling. Is it really only a few hours since we set sail? It's almost as if the last few years of my life never existed.
Oh, Bruce, I'm so happy for you. For us both.
Dr. Banner? Sorry to intrude, sir, but we got this priority message for you on the bridge. Captain said to bring it right down.
Thank you, Ensign.
Oh, no.
What can this be? Hulk on rampage. Jericho, New Mexico. Samson badly injured. Hulkbuster's beaten. Your presence required at Gamma Base. Is there no escaping him? Am I never to be free?
Bruce!
Dr. Banner!
Get a doctor, please. He's not breathing.
To be continued.
Bullpen Bulletin celebrates Marvel's 25th anniversary with the new year. It's finally 1986, and the year-long festivities can begin with these special issues, events, and even the launch of Marvel's new universe, which is sure to take off just like last year's blockbuster hits, Back to the Future and Brewster's Millions. You think they'll ever make a sequel to either of those?
Probably.
From the desk of Jim Shooter, editor-in-chief, comes this memo to readers.
Happy New Year! Way back in August of 1961, when popsicles were 6 cents. Tossin' and Turnin' by Bobby Lewis was the number one hit single, and nobody had ever heard of Vietnam. Fantastic Four number one hit the newsstands. That historic issue marked the beginning of the Marvel Universe and the launching of the Marvel Comics Group. We were one of the smallest comics companies then, but we took off like a starship and quickly grew into one of the biggies. Now as we approach our 25th birthday, we're the largest comics publisher in the Western world, and we did it the old-fashioned way. We earned it.
Well said, Jim. Simple, humble, and utterly marvelous.
Marvelous.
Hi, heroes. This is Gary Miller, Hulk fan emeritus and webmaster of DelusionalHonesty.com, here at the humble request of Smash Tales' very own Rick Hansen to say a few words about Incredible Hulk 319 and 320, the issues covered in this very podcast. I'll also be bringing to light some insights about the issue 320 that might have been, 321 and 322, and you get the idea. Issue 319 is, of course, the wedding of Bruce Banner and Betty Ross, which was a long time coming. It seemed at one point that Marvel tossed everything but the kitchen sink between these two. Writers Roy the Boy Thomas and Steve Baby Gerber married Betty off to Banner's rival Major Glenn Talbot in issue 158, Frenzy on a Faraway World. But that went over so horribly with the readership that Marvel spent the better part of the decade walking it back. Talbot was presumed dead for a time, then he came back. Then he was a Russian spy in disguise as Talbot. Then the real Talbot was brain dead. Then, thanks to the Hulk, he wasn't. It was a mel of a Hess. Of course, also in that time frame, Betty became a real harpy. Now, Bruce and Betty were together in a ceremony utterly unlike any other Marvel wedding out there in that it was not attended by any other superheroes. A nice, simple ceremony with Rick Jones as best man, talking with as much of a southern drawl as you're likely to ever see in print. The ceremony, interspersed with about the most inconsequential fight between Doc, Samson, the Hulkbusters, and the Hulk there could be, gets interrupted by Thunderbolt Ross, bringing all the usual suspects from Hulk No. 1 together in one room. Byrne said that Rick was meant to only appear for this one issue, ditto for Thunderbolt Ross, who was characterized as a bitter, out-of-touch old man who must let his daughter go. Something happened shortly after this issue went to press, and as I tell this story, please keep in mind it's only a subjective view of the events, near as I can piece them together. On his blog, Jim Shooter, then editor-in-chief at Marvel, noted he had been receiving complaints from Hulk editor Denny O'Neill's assistants that they were being burdened with work O'Neill himself should have been doing, so that O'Neill himself could devote more of his time to his freelance writing. Shooter called him on it, told him to do his job, and he looked at what had just come in from John Byrne, a Hulk story told entirely in splash pages, and immediately thought doing his job meant killing the book, and telling John that the reason he was doing so was because Shooter didn't like it. Byrne quit the book in protest. But that wasn't all. Byrne apparently also made a call to Jim Galton, then Marvel's president and Shooter's boss, demanding Shooter be fired over the incident. Galton called Shooter, asked who the hell John Byrne was, and also asked him to please keep these people from bothering him. Galton didn't fire Shooter, of course, and publisher Mike Hobson gave the order for Shooter to fire Denny O'Neill. That explains why there's not only a new writer-artist with number 320 in longtime Hulk editor and cover artist Alan Milgram, there's also a new editor in Bob Harris. And also, Bob Harris eventually became Marvel's editor-in-chief in 1996 and is now filling the same seat at the Distinguished Competition. A coda in this is that the story originally meant for issue 320, the all-splash page tale, Shooter thought it was great, and Al Milgram slotted it into the 29th issue of Marvel Fanfare. The exciting tale features an appearance by the Scourge of the Underworld as he kills longtime Hulk villains Hammer and Anvil. It's definitely worth checking out. The real issue 320 that saw a print by Milgram is a hastily assembled story. Milgram wasted no time in bringing back the Avengers, dropping Rick Jones's horrible accent, and giving Sam Larroquette a British accent for no readily apparent reason. He also began planting the seeds that would eventually reunite Banner and the Hulk. You might be saying to yourself, does anyone out there know what John Byrne would have done if he hadn't left the book with issue 319? Well, I'm so glad you asked. There are hints in issue 319 with Banner having talked to Rick about having there been potentially a way for him to be completely in control of the Hulk from the very beginning. Byrne also hinted by showing the original Hulk in issue 318, and in several publicity shots, he drew a Hulk that looked very much like the early Kirby version with the green skin and purple shorts from the original six issues. He also stated there would be a new Hulk, and that we'd later see the old Hulk for the final time. What seems obvious from interviews with Byrne conducted at the time is that he was planning to have Banner follow up on the comments made to Rick, exposing himself to gamma rays all over again and becoming a new Hulk, one closer in looks and temperament to the Lee Kirby original. The Hulkbusters, or Samson, would succeed in killing the original Hulk. Somehow, nobody would connect the dots and learn Banner was again the Hulk, putting that genie back in that particular bottle, and establishing the Hulk as a cunning creature of the night. Then we'd have had a Hulk who was like Banner most of the time, similar to Bill Mantlo's run, but who would have had to let the real Hulk out on occasion or else face severe consequences. We also already know who the new Hulk's first foe would have been, none other than the Metal Master, who would have animated the great adamantium statue of the Hulk carved by Alicia Masters, which had been on display in New York City until the mindless Hulk's rampage in issue 300. Also, Byrne made it clear that his new Hulk would have been green-skinned, not gray. Think of the consequences of that little decision, and ask yourself if the multiple personality angle that Peter David later explored could have been carried off as successfully with only one Keller of Hulk. I'll leave you to ponder that little point. If you hadn't seen it already, I'll refer you to my blog, delusionalhonesty.com, to read the rest of the story. It's 5 parts in all and covers all that I've told you about here and much, much more. Don't you dare miss it, true believers. Excelsior!
In this month's Green Mail, we'll be skipping over the letters from some readers who blather on about how much they're enjoying the series way better than before issue 315. A certain boisterous writer was doing a heck of a fine job before that issue, and I will not have his fine work disrespected on this show. Without further ado, our first letter comes from Bill Middleton of Clovis, New Mexico.
Keepers of the Hulk, the Incredible Hulk 317 was another very interesting chapter in the new adventures of Bruce Banner. The new Hulkbusters may not be much in the sheer power department, but when it comes to scientific genius, they'll certainly give the Big Green a run for his money. I only have 2 questions concerning this group. First of all, are all these scientists new characters? And second, why did Bruce Banner pick up specialists whose fields, at first glance anyway, kind of seem useless when in the overall scheme of destroying the Hulk? I mean, I can understand drafting a demolitions expert, but I can't really see how a marine biologist like Carolyn Parmenter is going to be able to help this group much.
A very interesting question.
Holy complications.
The Doc Samson subplot continued to carry this series all on action scenes, and I am finally beginning to like this character. Oh, that's funny. I was just thinking he was a jerk. I have never been able to swallow that a man who was almost as powerful as the Hulk could spend most of his time secluded away doing scientific research. With great power comes great responsibility and all that. So here's hoping that when the good Doc finally realizes that he isn't bad enough to capture the Hulk all alone, he'll eventually join the Hulkbusters and add some real power to this team. As for the Hulk himself, I couldn't be happier with his present characterization. Never has he been betrayed so savagely and powerfully. And in this particular story, you prove once and for all that the Hulk still has a semblance of intelligence, even if it is perhaps the only intelligence of a wary, hunted beast. My only complaint is that there, so far, Hulk only has seemed like a guest star in his own magazine. I do enjoy all the new subplots you've been developing in this comic, but I would also enjoy seeing more of this book's real star than you have so far presented. I must say that I've been very interested in your development of Bruce Banner, though. I don't know why, but I never really liked his character very much.
Oh my god!
Or even felt compelled to feel very much sympathy for his tragic situation. He's just been too wishy-washy over the years.
What do you mean? I take offense at that remark.
You know, milksop Banner. And even when he had the chance in the past to do something destructive with all the powers of the Hulk, he's always freaked out the last moment. Now he has a concrete purpose in life, the destruction of the Hulk, and his added backbone has led him even to propose to Betty Ross by the end of this issue. I've been waiting for this match for almost 20 years, and hope you guys don't do anything to mess it up.
Alright, to which Marvel replied, "We've never met any of the new Hulkbusters before, Bill, but we're sure that Bruce Banner had his reasons in making the choices he did, or at least we hope so. After all, they haven't exactly met with much success in their first meeting with the Hulk now, have they?" Next, we hear from Tom Dupree of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Kelly Hines of Signal Hill, California. Tom writes,
"Dear Hulk people, was the cover of The Incredible Hulk 317 the same cover that appeared in the background of Alpha Flight 26, page 20, 6 months ago?"
Followed by Kelly,
"Dear Hulkbusters, was it my imagination or was the cover of The Incredible Hulk 317 also in Alpha Flight 26 on page 20, panel 1?
To which new Hulk editor Bob Harris replies,
"No, Kelly, it wasn't your imagination. It was indeed the same cover in Alpha Flight, though those many months ago. And since you..."
Is Bob Harris British, apparently?
Yes.
To which... "Since you and Tom were the only 2 faithful fans to notice John Byrne's little sight gag, we're awarding you both a brand new shiny nail prize, just to prove that your new editorial representative can be generous."
Oh, he's such a saint.
Some of you may be aware of the similarity between the current Smash Tales storyline and the breaking news about the future status of the Incredible Hulk, once Marvel's Fear Itself event is played out. Hulk and Banner are both separate beings at present during our sensational show. But it's not the only time they've been separated, and at no time did it ever turn out well for very long. Some of you may be familiar with an event in the 90s called Heroes Reborn. During the battle with Onslaught, the Banner portion of our Emerald Hero woke up in the Heroes Reborn universe while his jolly green half kept on smashing up the good old 616. The Hulk began to show ill effects after being isolated from one half of his being, and when the heroes made their return, Banner rejoined with the Hulk, which was no big stretch since he had already been made himself into another Hulk in the Heroes Reborn world. Prior to this, way back in issue number 130, one of Bruce Banner's colleagues uses a device called the Gamatron to try and cure Banner, resulting in the two being separated, only to eventually have a showdown between the Hulk and the one Hulk hates most of all, Puny Banner. This was the story where the Hulk first met Jim Wilson, his second loyal sidekick, who's been in the Hulk's life almost as much as Rick Jones. Here, Banner fears for himself and the world if he is not reunited with the Hulk, and they spend a couple issues figuring out how to merge the two again. I guess Doc Samson took notes during that fiasco because he repeated the process in our last episode, only with more extreme results, since the Hulk no longer keeps his basic intelligence as he did back in issue 130.
You know, Samson, that was probably his log number one. Anyway, old Thunderbolt came into today's story as a downtrodden, miserable, and frail old man. Now how in the name of Jor-El did the man who commanded a substantial military base dedicated to hunting the Hulk come to this lowly state? General Ross was last seen colluding with MODOK in issue 287.
MODOK!
Where the two planned to defeat the Hulk. Ross, to prove his daughter that the Hulk was a menace, and MODOK to regain control of AIM by freeing the Abomination to fight Bruce Banner, who was in control of the Hulk's body at the time. This act amounted to no less than treason against the United States, as Ross assisted MODOK in penetrating a U.S. government facility. Now,
spoiler warning!
Years later, Ross entered into agreement with MODOK, which resulted in not only himself being transformed into the Red Hulk, but also turning Rick Jones into a gamma-powered behemoth known as A-Bomb. A variation on the name Abomination. Because, like, the A-Bomb is...
It's all full circle! Coming up next time, it's the battle you've all been waiting for. The Incredible Hulk versus everybody! We've got a veritable who's who of superheroes coming your way, and it's an even more of an expansive list than way back in issue 300. Today's tear-jerking wedding episode may have used up all your tissues, but next episode you better come wearing a helmet and a Kevlar vest, because there's going to be more punches thrown than in the past 20 issues combined!
Please don't count that.
Whatever you do, don't miss the next episode, True Believers. And if you still haven't gone and liked our Facebook page, you should go and do it now. You'll find us at facebook.com/SmashTales. And until next time, may your Green Lantern ring be three sizes too small and your gamma bombs be extra explodey. Thanks for listening, Smash fans. I'm Rick Hansen.
And I'm Ditsy Doo.
Fare thee well!
Hey everyone, Andrew Shaw back here again with another segment about Moon Knight. I got some really nice feedback after my last segment and thought, why not keep going? There are some really good Moon Knight stories out there and I thought I'd continue on and let everybody know as much information as I can about Moon Knight and his supporting cast and characters. So hopefully this episode will be just as informative as the first one, and hopefully a little bit longer. That was some of the feedback I got before too, was that it was a bit too short, so hopefully I'll be able to ramble on a bit more and make it just as interesting. I've been trying to think of a title for my segment. Looking back over some old issues, there was a letters column called Bark at the Moon, which I think is a fairly cool-sounding title, so we might stick with that unless anyone else can think of something better. So definitely give me some feedback on that. But this week, I'm actually going to talk about one of the villains plagued Moon Knight over the years, a female character by the name of Stained Glass Scarlet. So what I'll do is I'll go through a bit of her history, issue-related, and her fictional one. Then I'm going to talk about my favourite all-time Moon Knight story, which revolves around Scarlet, and just go through a little bit of that and what my thoughts on that story. And I've actually got a little bit of a special guest contributor this week. Some emails I sent back and forth with somebody who... But we will get to that later on. So, let's get started. Stained Glass Scarlet, first appearance in Moon Knight number 14. She was created by Doug Munch and Bill Sienkiewicz. Looking back over her history, she's appeared in 12 issues total. For a character who has such a fantastic history and is in my opinion, the best Moon Knight story of all time. It's not a whole lot of appearances. 11 out of those 12 being Moon Knight issues. And she also appeared with a little biography in Civil War Battle Damage Report. She appeared in a 4-issue Moon Knight miniseries by Doug Munch and Tommy Lee Edwards, and that was actually her last appearance. She hasn't shown up in any of the more modern Moon Knight. I'm hoping she will pop up in the Bendis run, but hey, you never know. Growing up, Scarlet wanted to be an actress or a nun. Abused as a child by her father, she murdered him by setting his bed on fire while he was laid up with a broken leg. The death was considered an accident, so she was never charged with anything. Eventually, Scarlet settled on her second chosen profession, joining a convent. One night, while in church, a man came in looking for a priest to confess. He handed Scarlet a gun. 6 months later, Vince and Scarlet Fascinero were married. 15 years they were married, even having a son, Joe, who later would be labelled Mad Dog. Eventually, Vince went back to his life of crime and was gunned down after a robbery gone wrong. Joe, at the time, was old enough to understand what happened with his father and grew to hate the police and any authority. This would eventually lead to his incarceration for killing a guard after a heist, almost inspired by his father. Moon Knight and Scarlet first met each other when her son escapes from prison. Scarlet ends up shooting and killing her son to protect Moon Knight, who was trying to save her at the time, but is devastated and later begins a one-woman war on the New York underworld members that helped turn her son into a mad dog. Scarlet is able to escape from Moon Knight. We don't see her again until the storyline I want to speak about today, Scarlet Redemption. Scarlet Redemption ran through issues 26 to 31 of Mark Spector Moon Knight. It was written by J.M. DeMatteis with art by Ron Garney and inks by Tom Palmer. The story opens with Scarlet attacking two of Mark Spector's confidants, Crowley, who she shoots with an arrow, and then throws him through a window at Gina's Diner, another person who's helped Mark Spector out a lot over the years. Scarlet attacks even further into the diner, and eventually and one of her stray arrows hits an oven, blowing up the diner. She's doing all this just to get Mark's attention, and judging from the first few pages, if you're going to try and get someone's attention, shooting one of their friends and blowing up a diner is probably a really good way to do it. Scarlet runs back to an abandoned church, which we've seen her in before in the Moon Knight series. This time she has three other women with her, dressed exactly like her, with red hair and red, or scarlet, if you will, capes. At this stage, Moon Knight is slowly becoming the, not as brutal as he used to be, probably more of a vigilante, to the point where he will hit and punch, but he won't severely injure. He tries to teach them a lesson, rather than actually injuring them and hurting them. It seems as we get further into the story that Mark Spector and Scarlet have some kind of psychic connection. Scarlet in the church looking up at a cross with Jesus on it, which suddenly turns into Moon Knight. And on the flip side, Mark Spector looking up at the statue of Khonshu he has in his house, which turns suddenly into Scarlet. He just assumes that she's after him, so it seems like they have some kind of psychic link, which is never really explained. But it does serve the story very well that they seem to finally meet up. There's a lot of back and forth between Moon Knight and Scarlet in this book. They seem to meet, then it seems like actually Moon Knight takes a fair beating in this book. He's shot with arrows and kicked and punched by Scarlet's offsiders. Scarlet also succeeds in beating up Frenchie while he's entertaining a lady friend in one of Mark's apartments. And having read further on the series, and if you also have read up further on the series, you know that Frenchie entertaining a lady friend later on is actually kind of out of character for him. Mark and Scarlet both seem to have hallucinations linked to each other. Mark seems to be stuck in the desert when he's in his own home, when he's looking at the Statue of Conchu, the sand and all sorts of stuff around him, where Scarlet in the church is dancing and seems to be attacked by flame and fire, which is part of her MO, having burned her father, and is now firebombing lots of apartments and stuff like that in New York. At one stage, she's attacked by what look like angels and demons in flame. As we get further into the second issue, though, Scarlet and Mark meet on top of a bridge in New York. Not knowing the area that well, I'm sure someone else better tell me which bridge it actually is. But they're on top, and Scarlet is on the bridge waiting for Mark. Mark arrives, and they have a bit of a back and forth. Mark just wanting to help her, whatever's affecting her. He wants to just help. She tells him she's the only one who can help, and he hugs her, and she just says to him, "Save me," and they kiss. And then, while they're kissing, Scarlet pulls a knife from her cloak, stabs Mark in the back, and throws him off the bridge into the water. And she looks down into the water and says to Mark, "I'm sorry, but I don't deserve to be saved. I deserve to burn." And she turns around and blows up the Angel Wing ship that he had arrived on. And as we end this issue, we see Mark Spector slowly sinking into the water. So the next issue, number 28, part 3 of Scarlet Redemption, is pretty much all about Mark. It shows him at the start falling off the bridge into the water. A bit of a spoiler warning, he does die. The series actually went on for another 30-odd issues, so it's not really a spoiler because you know that he does come back, but while he's in the water, and he does die, it takes a very spiritual turn in the story. He's confronted by his father, talking about how his father was very disappointed in him, but how he thought his father was silly because he believed in a god of love who was at best a fool. To quote from the book, his father again was a rabbi. There's little cutscenes showing Scarlet praying and Marlene back at the mansion, also hoping that Mark's okay. As Mark slowly sinks more, he's confronted by his brother, Randall, who made some appearances in the Hulk magazine black and white book many years ago. I won't spoil who he was for you because that's a really, really good story as well. But it shows how he looked up to his brother. He's always respected his brother, who was his protector, as he says. And they've both embraced railing against their father and not conforming to what their father wanted of them. Shows his brother as a soldier as well. As we get further and further down, he is finally confronted by Khonshu, who takes different forms, talking about showing his father, Jesus, and Khonshu again, talking about how he should be rebuilt, he shouldn't be a knight of vengeance anymore. He should be reborn as a beacon of hope, a ray of light in the darkness of the night. Have a little poetry there. And so Mark has to choose to live if he wants to continue on, and if he does choose, Khonshu will resurrect him again. He become a ray of light in the light of the moon, and Mark emerges from the water again. It's an absolutely excellent sequence. Very spiritual, very in-depth in the character of Mark and Moon Knight, and it's probably almost the best sequence in the whole book. He comes out of the water, and Marlene is there with Frenchie in one of the helicopters, and they pick him up. For some reason, Marlene just knew he was there. And we end with Scarlet on the water looking for Mark as well and noticing that he's not there anymore. And she's pretty annoyed. And she, as she gets all angry and angrier, the water around her turns to flame, and she screams right at the end, "This world must burn." Issue 29 is the opposite of issue 28 in that this one is more about Scarlet and what she's gone through in her life, showing her with her father and her husband and son and what she's gone through. And since I've gone through that earlier in for with a bit of a profile on her, I'll skip over that, but it just shows her, she's very religious, and it shows her with demons attacking her because she's sinned, and you know, her husband coming to get her again, and then her son, and her pulling the trigger on her son again with Moon Knight not able to save her. And it seems like she's got a bit of pyrokinesis, I think it's called, like Drew Barrymore in Firestarter, because she sets the room she's in on fire, and her and the women she had gave sanctuary to at the church have to escape for their lives. And it ends that there's going to be a battle for lives and souls, and it shows Mark has recovered from his wounds, and Scarlet, both in fairly dramatic poses, and Mark saying this madness ends. Issue 30 opens with New York being firebombed in different areas by Scarlet and her followers, showing absolute carnage, panic in the streets, and, you know, you'd think, looking at these pages, you'd think she would catch the eye of one of New York's many other superheroes, Spidey, or the Punisher, Fantastic Four, even Daredevil, but no, it just seems like it's all up to Mark Spector, which is the way it should be. There's a really nice sequence following that about two Indian tribes people, a man and a woman, and it talks about how Scarlet's, this is a dream that Scarlet's having, and it talks about how that this is a lot of based on her life, that the man ends up jumping into the fire, but the woman hesitates and won't jump in, and Scarlet's sort of saying that, you know, she's hesitated all her life, and this time she needs to get on with it and do what she needs to do. And we follow on with Mark rescuing lots of people. He thinks one building's abandoned, so he's happy that it's getting... He's not happy, but he's not concerned it's been blown up, except he hears a few screams and ends up rescuing a woman and child from there. He takes on Scarlet's followers again, getting a bit of a beating again. But he somehow is transported into Scarlet's dream of the tribesman and shows him standing next to the fire in his Moon Knight gear. He's visited by Khonshu and his father again in this dream in the fire, and when he comes out, he knows exactly where Scarlet is, so there's more of the psychic link between the two. Scarlet goes to finish off Crowley, who's still in hospital after being attacked, but is foiled by Mark, who is in his Moon Knight gear in the bed. It shows them battling again, and intercut with scenes from the dream of the two tribesmen dancing around the fire, the man and the woman. And Scarlet, they're in a hospital, and Scarlet has actually set the hospital on fire as they fight. Mark's trying to rescue people, and they end up on top of the bridge again, where Mark was murdered before. Brought back to life, and he says it's over, Scarlet, and they start to fight. She produces a knife again, and this time Mark's able to stop her and takes the knife away from her, and instead of Mark falling, Scarlet plunges off the bridge to what is possibly her death. So Mark follows in after her, just to try and find her, but she's gone, she's missing. And as he climbs back out of the water, we see one of her hands break the water and then slowly sink back in. And it ends with a passage, Mark looking over the bridge, and it says, "In the end, there is lightning flashing without a sound. There is the wind and the water and the man. He stands for hours, watching every shape and shadow, every glint of light, every hint of movement, and as he watches, he wonders about dreams and memories, hidden pains, and past lives, about souls bound, souls freed, and the difference, if any, between the two. And when he's finally done with his watching and wondering, he does something he hasn't done since he was a boy. He says a prayer, for Stainglass Scarlet, and for himself. Then a part of him mourning, another part relieved, still another part filled with an inexplicable, ineffable joy, the man turns and continues on his way. Issue 31, the final issue in this series, is an epilogue. It shows the changes Mark has undertaken from the experience with Scarlet, and how instead of being a ridiculously violent vigilante, he's now just stopping people by talking to them or just scaring them to be good, scaring them out of killing people because of who he is, instead of beating them and injuring them and putting them in hospital or even killing them. He is showing it that he can actually do this without dishing out absolute pain. And it ends with him and Marlene finally getting together properly and kissing and flying off into the sunset together. So that's the end of the story. And just as a little side note, it ends, the last page is Hobgoblin coming after Mark, which I actually don't have the issues of, I'm trying to find at the moment. But that's pretty much Scarlet Redemption story-wise. This is my number one favourite story of Moon Knight. There aren't any that surpass it, in my opinion. It shows that J.M. Demetri has had an absolutely beautiful understanding of the characters, and reading it, it's almost like an epic poem to me. Going through, looking at the art and the story together, Mark and Scarlet come across as a couple of dancers, moving together back and forth, pushing each other away, pulling each other together, back and forth, until, you know, building up to this massive ending where it just builds and builds and builds, and it just becomes frenetic, and it's absolutely beautiful. And it just shows that Demetrius and even Garney on the art showed so much of a understanding of where these two were. Lots of religious iconography, of course, showing Scarlet as an ex-nun, lots of church with Jesus on the cross, and Mark with his father who was a rabbi, and also having the Egyptian god, showing a lot of Khonshu and that sort of thing. Demetrius uses a lot of different quotes at the start of each issue from people like Meher Baba, John Newton, a Bible quote from the Gospel of John, William Blake, and Percy Bysshe Shelley. He also gets Mark to tell a very interesting story at the start, early on in the first issue, about a snake, which I will pass on to you now. It's Mark telling it from the perspective that his father told him a story once about a Jewish area in Poland. There was a poisonous snake that lived in the fields outside that village, and he was a nasty piece of work. No sooner would someone set foot in those fields than the snake would rise up and bite them. The poison was deadly, death was instantaneous. The snake was shrewd, devious. No trap could catch him, he always got away. But in time, conscience did what the townspeople couldn't. The snake thought of all the lives he'd taken. All the suffering he caused, he was consumed with guilt, and he repented for his sins. The snake cried out to God for help. Forgiveness, grant me forgiveness. At first no answer came. Then one day a miracle rabbi came to the village, a man of great wisdom and spiritual power. The snake crawled timidly up to the master's feet. Rabbi, please, he begged. I've lived such a sinful life. Is forgiveness possible for a wretch like me? The rabbi told the snake he could indeed grant him expiation from his sins, but in return, he said, you must make me a promise. Anything, the snake said. Never bite anyone again, the rabbi commanded, and the snake agreed. In the months that followed, the snake was as good as his word. No new victims fell to his poisonous fangs. But as the snake retreated, the villagers grew curious, then bold. They journeyed out into the field, taunting the snake, laughing and hurling stones. The snake offered no resistance. The villagers grew more brazen, trampling and tormenting the poor creature till he hid himself away. Eventually, the great rabbi returned, found the snake in a sad and pitiful state. "What's happened to you?" the rabbi asked. "I did what you said," the snake wept. "I kept my word. I've bitten no one." "Good," said the rabbi. "Good," howled the snake. "They abuse me, torture me. I'm broken and miserable. Death would be preferable to this." Anger gleamed in the rabbi's eyes. "You fool," he roared. "I told you not to bite. I didn't tell you not to hiss." And this story is almost an analogy for where Mark does go from this, along in the story with Scarlet, showing that at the start he was a very brutal person, beating people and not really caring for the welfare of the victims that he was attacking. And eventually, and in the end, he becomes more of a scary character rather than a brutal person. He uses his words and inflicting fear into his victims rather than breaking arms and legs. Garney's art also does help, especially in a lot of the cutscenes. The little offshoot scene with the Indian man and woman dancing around the fire, the art is a totally different, a bit more of a scratchy style, and it works so well within the story. But yeah, like, absolutely love the story. I would assume that you could probably get these fairly cheap, seeing as how it is Moon Knight, and he doesn't seem to be the most popular character out there, but I picked them up fairly easily, and if you can find it, please do pick it up. I guarantee you'll love the story. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I had a bit of a guest contributor to my segment this week. I thought I would try and do something a little bit special. This is my second go at this, and you know, I wanted to make a good impression and make people want to hear more from me and what I'm saying. And I was on Twitter and sent off a tweet to JMD Mateus himself about the book, asking him just for a little bit of insight on what he remembers from writing the story at the time. And he was nice enough to send me his email address, so I sent him off an email, and we had a bit of an email conversation going back and forth one night, and absolutely a lovely person, and I was absolutely rapt that he not only gave me his email address, but was happy to answer my questions and give me as much as he could remember. And so he gave me permission to quote him from some of his stuff that he wrote to me, and I'll just read some of his quotes here about Scarlet Redemption. "I wanted to redefine and clarify the character, kill and rebirth him, if you will. The end result was supposed to be a guy who operated not from a perspective of vengeance, but from a perspective of compassion. In order to get him there, of course, we had to put him through the ringer, and he certainly went through a major ringer in that story. I also recall looking through some of the earlier issues, coming across the character of Scarlet and being intrigued by her. Again, I wanted to redefine and clarify the character, filling in her backstory and deepening her links to Moon Knight. Her story, if I recall, dealt fairly clearly with issues of child sexual abuse, something I had explored in other books at the time. Scarlet Redemption was a very odd, passionate and poetic story, very different from the average Moon Knight story, and to be honest, I was never sure that it succeeded or if people actually appreciated it." The last quote there about not being sure if people actually appreciated the story, I find that the story hasn't probably had its dues. It's probably, as I've said, the best Moon Knight story, and it's never actually been collected. So I guess if you do go out and get the story and really enjoy it, please, if you're on Twitter, let him know, because I'm sure Mr. DeMatteis would really appreciate to know that there are more people out there who actually enjoy the story. So that's it from me this week. I hope you enjoyed it. It was a bit longer than the last time I was on there. Thanks again to David for letting me do this, and an absolutely special, very special thanks to Mr. James DeMatteis for giving me those quotes for the story and giving me a bit of a background and insight as to what he was thinking at the time when writing this story. I'm glad I could let him know how much I appreciated it. And so, yeah, so thanks again. I'm on Twitter at Andrew_Shaw23 if you're inclined to follow me. Also on the boards as Andrew, aka Fist of Khonshu. But yeah, drop me a line if you've got any feedback. I'd really appreciate anything you have to say about it. And so, yeah, thanks. So I guess I'll see you next time on Bark at the Moon.
Hey, Coon Moon pedestrians! Sons of the Tiger, Steve Raker, and Andrew are L.A. Rabbit, here from the underground dojo that is the comic book bunker. Good to have you back as a sparring partner, buddy.
Thanks for inviting me back to the bunker, Steve. Always a pleasure.
This week we've got martial arts mayhem in the magnificent Marvel manner, as only Mighty Marvel can mix it up, as we're going to delve into the recently released Iron Fist Marvel Masterworks Volume 1 hardcover. And Iron Fist has been one of my favorite characters since I was a wee lad. It's just that these original issues were on the newsstand when I was first trying out and buying comics in, in 75 and 76. So these are some of the comics that I've had the longest of any of the comics in my collection.
For me, I really like the character design. Normally, I like capes and everything, but there's something about the green and yellow with the large collar and kind of the belt and the mask tails that run behind that just always caught my eye. And also the split open with the dragon on the chest and everything. It was just always an eye-catching character that you were like, what? I gotta check that out. What's going on there?
It's an awesome design from Gil Kane, who designed his costume. From Roy Thomas's introduction in the Masterworks, he liked the name Iron Fist for a while, Roy did, but was really hesitant to use it given that Marvel already had Iron Man, and kind of after a while he figured, it's not that much of a stretch for Marvel to, have another Iron something character. And Gil Kane simultaneously was wanting to do a riff on one of his Golden Age childhood favorites, which was Bill Everett's Amazing Man. Now, the Amazing Man, he was a guy named John Amen. Get it? A-Man? Amazing Man? His last name? And so John Amon gets rescued. He gets taken in and then trained to fight in the mystical alpine city of Shangri-La, which had been brought to popular culture consciousness about a decade or maybe 15 years prior to Everett's character here. So then this John Amon, Amazing Man, goes out into the world after having earned the wrath and made an enemy of Shangri-La's ruler, the Hooded Great Question. So you'll see that a lot of these concepts are really get played through into the Iron Fist mythology. And it's also pretty cool that recently, given Ed Brubaker's Immortal Weapon character, John Amon, which is obviously a homage to all of this in the current continuity. Pretty cool. Now, publishing history-wise, just to kind of make a framework for where these issues lie, these first original origin issues, in 1974 and 1975, for 10 issues of Marvel Premiere, issues 15 through 25, that makes it 11 issues, Iron Fist debuted. And there was a variety of writers and artists that we'll get into as we cover the material. Then in 75 and 76, Iron Fist solo series, number 1 through 15, ran its course, and that was written by Claremont with art by Jocular John Byrne. Then also in 75 and 76, Iron Fist made some appearances in the black and white Marvel magazine Deadly Hands of Kung Fu in issues 10, 18, and then had a running serial in issues 19 through 24. It was a Marvel team-up appearance in 75. Then there was a two-issue Marvel team-up appearance with Spider-Man and the Daughters of the Dragon that Iron Fist was featured in 1977 that wrapped up the loose ends from the Iron Fist series that tied everything together. Then the Power Man and Iron Fist combination began in Luke Cage's title with issue 48, became Power Man and Iron Fist. This was in 1977 and ran through 1986 all the way up to issue 125 when our hero here was unfortunately and very unsatisfactorily killed off. There were a few Marvel team-up annuals, and there was a ROM appearance, etc. But it wasn't until 1991 when John Byrne, of all people, would bring back Iron Fist in his Namor the Submariner series. In issues number 16, which was just a false alarm, but got Namor on the case of trying to figure out what the heck happened to Iron Fist. And then in issues 20 through 25, he brought Iron Fist back. Since then, there were a number of limited series in 96, in 97, in 98. One was written by James Felder with Robert Brown. That was 2 issues. In 98, there was a 3 issues by Dan Jurgens and Butch Geis, which was kind of cool. There was a short-lived 19-issue Heroes for Hire series and an annual that were all written by John Ostrander with Pasquale Ferry art in 97 and 98. And there were a few more limited series. There was one with Wolverine that was 4 issues by Jay Farber and Jamal Igel in 2000. And in 2004, Kevin Lau drew a 6-issue Iron Fist series. That brings us up to the current run continuity where Ed Brubaker and Matt Fraction brought Iron Fist back in the Immortal Iron Fist series that ran 27 issues plus an annual and some specials from 2007 to 2009. Had a few limited series here and there since, and Iron Fist's new Avengers appearances, and there's going to be, obviously, a new Defenders series that was just announced at San Diego Comic-Con that should tickle my fancy, and I hope it tickles yours too, Andrew.
Yes, for sure, and certainly, obviously, the Heroes for Hire has featured him recently, and I believe those, I think they might be doing the Iron Fist and Power Man as a series of future limited series, because I've had 2 in a row, and I wouldn't be surprised to see a third one, because I think that's how they're going to keep the new Power Man character,
right,
who's the new younger version. I think that's how that incarnation is going to continue to resurface.
And for those of you who want to get a kind of possible sneak peek onto what the purpose is or the issues that face this potential new Defenders team, check out the last 3 issues of Iron Man 2.0, which is the new War Machine title, which was a Fear Itself tie-in. It's got Doctor Strange, the Immortal Weapons, and War Machine taking on Iron Fist, who's controlled by Agamotto and like an avatar of Agamotto at this point. Things are happening to the character. But let's go way back. Come on, way back with me, boys and girls. And we'll see how things started out for this character. Issue 15 of Marvel Premiere was written by Roy Thomas with art by Gil Kane, and that'd be the only issue that these guys would do together. The next issue, 16, was written by Roy and Len Wein with art by Larry Hama. Then 3 issues by Doug Munch and Larry Hama. 3 issues by Tony Isabella and Avril Jones. 3 issues by Chris Claremont with Pat Broderick, and then John Byrne, and then Iron Fist's solo series started, which was Claremont and Byrne. And oddly, this Marvel Masterworks covers all 11 issues of the Marvel Premiere stuff, and the first 2 issues of the Claremont-Byrne Iron Fist series.
Which leaves us on a bit of a cliffhanger.
It does.
Unfortunately.
But as Andrew and I were running the numbers before we began recording, this would lead to a second Iron Fist Marvel Masterworks volume being the exact same size of 13 issues and finishing off that series if we were lucky enough to have them publish one.
I'm certainly hoping for one.
Issue number 15 of Marvel Premiere brought a shining new star in the flame-flecked Marvel heavens, and it was planned, plotted, and published by Roy Thomas and Gil Kane, who even at the end of the issue gave a series dedication to the memory of Bill Everett and called him a most amazing man, so they weren't hiding at all where they were getting their inspiration for this character from. The series opens with Iron Fist in a tournament fighting 4 guys for the right of immortality in front of UT, who is a hooded ruler of the mystical city Kunlun, and 4 dragon lords that surround him. And we get the whole concept introduced of naming all the kung fu moves as they're being used. You know, you get the rock smash blow and the elephant kick and the dragon stomp and the monkey blow.
I always wondered if those were real moves or not. I have no knowledge of kung fu or martial arts. They sound like they could be, but they equally could be just made up.
The ram's head blow, the sword hand. I could go on and on. And it also introduces this classic Iron Fist I guess, cliche in, at this point, of the narrator caption boxes speaking directly to Iron Fist as if it's an echo of his own thoughts. You know, you are the Iron Fist, you know. In your mind's eye, you see yourself doing this or that. It leads to a different type of read when you're paging through.
It's in, the second person is not... there's only been, I think, a few novels that have really capitalized on the second. And it's not a true second person, because there will be scenes where he is not present. And in a, obviously in a complete second person novel, you would only be have access to what you are there for.
Sure.
When you're put in the character. But it was interesting to see a modified second person. And I didn't have any real problem with it, because you kind of need to be put in a different mindset, because we have a not a traditional superhero, but there's a lot of distinctions that they make. I think the character is neat because he has a lot of weird notions from growing up in the city. Although I had pronounced it Kun Lun, but I'm probably doing it wrong. So when you said Kun Loon, I'm like, wait, that's the problem when you only read these things. You're like, I need a pronunciation guide for the mystical city.
Your guess is as good as mine. I certainly called it Kun Lun when I was, I even tried to throw the little kind of dash in there. I've heard Ed Brubaker over the last few years and Fraction calling it Kun Loon, and that works. That works for me.
Yeah, if anyone would know, it would be them, so.
So the Fist, while he's fighting here, has a flashback. He's recalling his family's alpine trek, his father's search for this mystical city of Kun Loon, you know, an allegory to Shangri-La. And they've got his dad's business partner, Harold Meacham, along. And Danny and his mother, Danny's a young boy, 8, 9, 10 years old maybe, they fall off an ice bridge. And Meacham, very... not altruistically, pushes Wendell Rand, Danny's dad, you know, off the edge. And there's quite an interesting, quite brutal panel from Gil Kane. That's a full-page splash of Wendell, his face bleeding in the shadows, kind of bouncing off a ledge on his way, being pushed down the mountain to his death in front of his wife and son.
The 70s had a... strangely brutal trend. This was the era of the Ghost Rider comic, and the panel right before that full-page splash, you see the crampons on the cleats on the boot, and there's like this dark, it's not red, but you got to presume it's blood. I mean, it was a strangely grim. While they're still okay for children, it did have a lot more violence than you might think. At least for those of us that I grew up on a lot more 80s comics, where they sort of had that violence, but they sort of cleaned up any kind of blood or anything. So it was kind of interesting reading these ones that are a little bit edgier.
Yeah, Meacham steps on Wendell's hands as he's hanging off the ledge. And, you know, I guess they didn't have their act together, certainly, as an alpine trekkers, because even as a kid in the Canadian Rockies, when I was like 7, learned that, you know, you're all roped together, and if one person falls, the other people just fall to the ground and put their ice axes in, and they act as anchors. And then the people who are falling don't fall no more. This served the purpose, and a young Iron Fist, Danny, has lost his dad here and is stuck on a ledge with his mom, with his dad's killer up above, and... Danny's mother is throwing rocks at him and kind of sends him off after he professes his bizarre love for her.
It seemed like a weird way to win her over. Like, absolutely. I'm no expert in romance, but killing the woman's husband in front of her, maybe not going in front of her and her son, maybe not the way to impress her. I don't know. I mean, what do I know about romance?
Yeah, but he gives her one of those, like, I did it all for you kind of comments or something. But then Danny and his mom, they decide they're going to climb. And climb they do. They make it. Unfortunately, though, they're hungry and they're vulnerable, and they end up getting chased by a pack of wolves, you know, towards the edge of a ravine. But there's a bridge. And they realized their, you know, Wendell Rand was onto something, that here is likely the bridge to Kunlun. And his Danny's mom pushes him ahead and martyrs herself to keep the wolves occupied, so that Danny can, you know, have a chance to live.
And I got to say, this era is kind of right at the edge when I started reading. So for me, these books have a real fondness because they're right at the beginning. They were kind of right before I started, and I didn't have access to a lot of back issues or conventions. So if I was to come across issues like this, it was a very rare treat for me as a little kid. So they have not only that nostalgia to them, but just they were almost out of reach. But I have to say, even in hindsight now, this is a very pretty issue. Gil Kane does a lot of that, what I remember from his Spider-Man work, some of the same positions and images of the character and the sort of ghost images in the background. And they put just enough background detail, but it's not overly done so, but it just gives you perspective of where they are. I know a lot of people make fun of the lack of background detail, but I think there's plenty in most of the panels to place you where you are. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm much more interested in the characters in the foreground anyways.
Yeah, I hear you. There's a great kinetic flow to reading the book, the way that it's presented here, and I'm sure that was somewhat by design, since we're talking about a kung fu comic book. Also, the coloring, the remastering of the colors here is beautifully done in this book. I, not that long ago, whipped out my old copies from the 70s, and, you know, it's hard to read some of that cloudy stuff now, and really enjoy them. And boy, it really, the colors really stand out and contrast against each other, as only 70s and 80s comics can.
Although they did make that's in the next issue, his chest tattoo is sometimes red, which is a little distracting. But yeah, the colors do come out, because it helps, because that's how they, because the panels, more for the later artists, they even go to like 12-panel grids and things like that, so you don't really have the room in the background. So just by offering a little bit of color in the background, I think it sets it off quite nicely. And like you said, gives it that kinetic movement. And I know it's not for everybody, but I would suggest trying it, because it's a different, it's an art style you just don't see anymore. Because like I said, they're putting more panels on. That first issue is more traditional, but some of the later ones you'll see, like I said, 12 panels on a page and things like that.
It's crazy.
And it's just a fun way to look at a different way to tell a comic book story.
And an action sequence, you know, where you're actually getting to see each move and parry, not, you know, not a few poses on a page and then, you know, you get the idea and the story moves along. But getting to see, you know, a battle where the hero gets knocked down, he gets backed up, the other guy gets knocked down, and back and forth, it's surprisingly refreshing.
Yes, by solely of the fact that it's different, but you also have really nice artists. I mean, you know, who doesn't like Larry Hama? I remember him from the G.I. Joe stuff when I was younger.
Sure.
And the other thing that draws my eye are these covers. Again, back in those days, at least for me, the cover was probably the primary marketing tool. You know, I don't read previews now. I certainly wasn't reading. I don't know if they existed back then.
No.
So for me, it was like a character you knew, or you'd look at these covers. And if the cover caught your eye, then that would be, you know, because if you're a little kid, you can't just buy every issue on the thing. You only have whatever money you have, and you get to buy.
You only have a dollar.
Yeah. You buy, you know, whatever four comics you want, and you got to pick the four, and it's going to be, you know, I was a Spider-Man guy, so whatever Spider-Man, and then whatever extra it would be, you know, what looked cool on the cover.
Now, I should say, even though Gil Kane only drew the first issue here, issue 15 of Marvel Premiere, he did draw the covers of this entire run of the Marvel Premiere book. So that's 11 Gil Kane covers. So it really had a nice, consistent look that was really indicative of the art in this first issue, since it's all Gil. Now, the Iron Fist, back in his present in this tournament after defeating those four guys, he also faces, like, this big masked opponent called Shuhu, whose lips are pledged to silence, they say, and whose name means lightning, right? And
He also quite effectively shoots a fully handled knives from the palm of his hand, so watch out for that. And he's beaten down and stabbing the fist until he basically goes into a berserker rage, Iron Fist does. Even, you know, he's using the pain constructively, so to speak, and he strikes again and again and yet again, Andrew.
And to further drive it, this is one of the few times where they drop the monkey blow and elephant slab and like, they use that sometimes, but here, much probably for the dramatic effect, it creates a sense of tension, because normally you have this sort of running dialogue of what's going on, where this, it's meant to, I think, just evoke the sort of desperation play, and I think it was an effective storytelling technique.
Yeah, a few issues later, they do the multiple again and again and again thing again, though. that's pretty funny.
And certainly his we're about to learn why he's called Iron Fist, and that sequence will play itself out.
Yeah, we get the first Iron Fist, the culmination of his inner self and chi brought to his fist and make it crackling, and Iron Fist gives this Shuhu an iron fist to the face. Good thing it's just a robot. You know? I don't know why he'd have to be pledged to silence and everything if he was just a robot, but I don't know. Those sneaky Coon Loonies, or Coon Loonians, whatever you call them. I think Coon Loonies is a good...
Well, what threw me a little bit was they made it seem like they're this kind of mystical, magical city, and yet they have robots. Like, it seemed an interesting mix of genre. I was expecting maybe some kind of magically animated, you know, maybe he punches them and he turns into stone or something, rather than it being a robot seemed a little bit odd.
He's a robot sworn to silence who shoots knives out of his hand and whose name means lightning. Woo!
And he is one bad, bad character, but I do like the until it becomes like onto a thing of iron.
Absolutely. And victorious, Iron Fists earn the right to choose between immortality, eternal life, and death. And that's where the issue ends. Which does he choose, the lady or the tiger?
And to further go back to some of the, not to harp on this, but the storytelling technique, because in the previous scenes we have, as Steve said, one blow per panel, what's kind of fun about the first time they invoke the Iron Fist is they fully devote 7 panels to it.
Yeah.
So it gives you it kind of changes the pacing in a much more effective way, whereas he noted now in modern storytelling, kind of the pacing, it moves a little bit, but it's more going from slow to slower, usually are the two speeds, where here you have kind of very rapid pace, so when you deliberately slow it down, it really, at least for me, had a very powerful impact. In a way, I don't think you get such a stark contrast in a lot of comics nowadays.
Absolutely.
And like I said, it's just fun for those of you that haven't read some of these older ones. It's kind of neat to see a different way to do it.
In issue 16, we get Iron Fist suddenly in an alley in New York City. We'll get to why later, which is another interesting way storytelling technique here that we keep seeing, which is a lot of different time shifts back from his time in Kunlun back to his time in this tournament and getting the choice between immortality and death, and where he's at now, which is New York City. And again, he takes on 4 thugs. That seems to be a good number, kind of an even match for Iron Fist. And we get more kung fu moves. We get the lightning block, the bear thrust. The sword hand does the trick, although Iron Fist takes a good pipe to the head along the way, unfortunately.
And here we have our Larry Hama issue, although I like the art, but some of it, when he's taking on the 4 guys, the art almost looks like he punches practically through the midsection of one of the guys.
It sure does.
With a palm. And I'm like,
and there's a little Kirby crackle there, too.
I mean, they make an effort to show in the next scene he's actually the one that clubs him in the head, so you know it didn't go through. But when you first look at it, it looks like he almost punched through his entire midsection.
Now tell me this, Andrew, and I should have taken the time to look it up before we took the time to sit down together here. But did Dick Giordano, who is the inker over Larry Hama in this issue and does a fantastic job, by the way, did he and Klaus Janson of Daredevil inking fame, did they used to work in the same studio or anything in the 70s? Because there are a few double-page sequences that I would swear was inked by Klaus Janson. Pages 29 and 30 and 31 of this Masterworks, and pages 7 and 8, where the brushwork changes very much from Giordano's style. And I mean, I look at it and I immediately think I'm reading a Daredevil comic. It's so striking to me. And I wonder if they used to work together, because I think there may have been pages changing art tables here to get everything done by a deadline.
That could be. I wonder if the other thing, particularly with the segments on the pages 29 and
30 and 31,
the other thing that's really strange is it's a lot less panels, and I wonder if that had something to do with it. Where normally, as I was saying before, these are very panel heavy, they sort of pull back, and I wonder if that changed his volume of like how he was approaching it,
yeah,
as opposed to when you're inking the smaller panels.
I can see
what you mean about the Klaus Janson.
So anyway, the drama of Iron Fist getting the pipe to the head and fighting the thugs in the alley is interlaced with memories of Iron Fist's from Kunlun that continue his origin story along. The masked UT, who is the August personage in Jade, who's the equivalent of the Great Question from the old Amazing Man stuff. He welcomes young orphaned Danny Rand to Kunlun and basically says he's going to give him anything he wants, and all he wants is revenge. And that's what Danny spends the next 10 years of his life really devoted to. Kunlun comes into contact with Earth's dimensional frequency once every 10 years. So he's got 10 years before he can go back and avenge his father's and mother's death and seek out Harold Meacham. So
and we're also going to see played out that while he is devoted to this motif of revenge, it is kind of not within his character in general. And that's an interesting conflict that you'll see played out, particularly in the last issue we're going to cover, how it's noted how even though he has this drive, you get the feeling from the character that he's not really that sort of a person. And he's generally pretty balanced except for this one overwhelming drive, but it doesn't, he's not like the Punisher in that sense or wherever, where it overtakes the rest of his sensibility.
And we get to meet Lee Kung, the Thunderer, who Danny is turned over to be tutored in the martial arts, and we see him go from the basics to being able to make great leaping kicks and snatching crowns off of serpents' heads with a quick flick of the wrist, and punching a deep bucket full of sand, and then when that's not tough enough, then gravel and then buckets of rock to harden up his fists. He's becoming a man.
My favorite kung fu trope that they didn't do is I like the ones in the movies where they have to punch through the big bucket of water and break the stuff at the bottom of the bucket of water.
Right.
Like, I like those. Those are also my favorite sort of standard kung fu training technique, you know, punch through, 4 gallons of water and shatter the thing on the bottom.
Then Danny is off to face Xiao Lao, the Undying, who is a large dragon who's in his lair. And Danny's pretty outmatched here, but he figures out that he can block the heart of the undying dragon's power source, which is what ends up being Danny's tattoo on his chest, which is on the dragon's chest. He's going to block it with his body in a bear hug, and that cuts him off from whatever mystical energies keep this big dragon replenished, and he ends up being victorious.
And they do a good job about making sure it's the reverse image, which I was proud to see.
Yeah, they do. They do at that. And this sequence is the sequence on that pages 29 through 31 that I was talking about that seemed really inked by Janson. Danny advances past the corpse of the dragon to his cauldron, which is the heart of the dragon, and his fists go in, again and again and again. until they shine and they're smoldered and they need to be cooled in the outside snow. And that's how he harnesses the power of the Iron Fist.
And as Steve was remarking, they always intercut this stuff, which I think is smart because I guess they didn't want someone to feel like this is just going to be his growing up adventure. So they're intercutting it with his taking on the latest baddie, who is Scythe, this man with all these complicated weapons.
Yeah. Also, to wrap up just the Kunlun piece of it, you get that show that Danny then goes to this tournament challenge with the four and with the robot Chuhu guy. And then he gets that choice, right? The death or the immortal life. And he chooses the equivalent of death, which is his revenge on Meacham. He's going to, 10 years is up, and Earth is accessible again from Kunlun, and he's going to go try to seek his revenge out rather than staying in the Immortal City and eating of the apple, which is a funny symbolism that UT is holding in his hand. Also, UT drops the old "your father was my brother" bit on Danny as he's leaving, just to mess him up a little bit in the head.
And these books are lots of fun because you'll get that. Particularly once we get past the first two or three issues, it seems like every other issue or so they'll drop some hint about a future storyline, which I really enjoy. Some character makes an appearance for a few panels and then is like, says something mysterious, and then you know, like, 5 issues later, whatever, you're going to see that guy again, but he's gone for now. You know, it's just a little taste of what's to come.
Which is amazing, given all the different writers that had their hands in the pot for this first, what ends up being 8-issue origin story of the Fist. And now you've mentioned Scythe, this bladed character that Iron Fist is next facing in New York. And this guy's got a ball and a chain and a scythe. And he's kicking Iron Fist's butt until the Fist uses his Iron Fist to shatter this guy's weapon. And at that point, the scythe guy, he sings like a Kung Fu canary, right? He's fingering his boss as being named Meacham, and he's even pointing out the skyscraper that Meacham owns. He's over there. That's his office, you know? So now he's pointed the Fist in the right direction.
I wonder if this character ever came back. He seemed like kind of an interesting, I mean, clearly he's a skilled combatant, and he had kind of a swagger to him. I kind of liked, I wished, you know, instead of the last we get is that he's no longer a man, only a broken soulless husk. I'm like, wow, so he get beat up? He really lost, you know, it lost his swagger and his soul and everything else.
He lost his groove. Issue number 17 of Marvel Premiere, we've gotten the Fist boarding an elevator in the Meacham building, getting towards his quarry. And this scene is so ordinary, except for Iron Fist's appearance, that it really reminds me of that great scene in the original Blues Brothers movie where they get on the elevator together and the elevator music is playing and, there's tons of SWAT teams and everything chasing them, yet they're on this elevator, checking their watch and just taking their time. Pretty funny. Anyway, Iron Fist faces trap after trap going through this building on his way to Meacham's office. It's like a high-rise murder world, Andrew, right? There's knives from the walls, machine guns from the floor, vaporization, door traps, bombed stairs, thugs with guns, trap doors, a wolf, a gas chamber, a samurai janitor, colliding elevators, laser cannons, you name it.
And I think that Hama's art is even better in this issue. I think you watch him come along, and there's some nice, what I would guess, I couldn't quite tell, but it looks like they might have even lifted the panels right out of the origin one when they're doing some of the flashback. Either that or he's mimicking Gil Kane pretty well on some of those close-ups there that I enjoyed. And I just thought this one flowed a little bit better. Although I can see as a single issue, the idea of kind of walking through the death trap doesn't give you... It's kind of interesting to see all these different traps, like the janitor is really an assassin and everybody just hanging out or spies, and he has to use all his almost superhuman kung fu senses to figure out the traps. But it kind of as a solo issue, I was a little bit like, really? Like, we don't get any sense of conclusion or anything.
Well, I also thought of it in some ways as the kata, or the dance that the fist had to go through. The kata in the martial arts is a series of predetermined moves that have to be done in sequence that, you know, are in some ways a disciplined dance, if you will. He had to duck, he had to move, he had to twist, he had to climb on the outside of the building for a few floors. This was just the hoops he had to jump through, quite literally, to get to his prey. And before he gets to his prey, he gets to the first bottleneck, which is a chamber occupied by this guy, Triple Iron. And that's where the issue ends.
And there is some, for all the people that like to knock some of the old ones, they keep the consistency because his costume gets slowly eroded, and they keep, each time there's more nicks, and so through the whole run, like even into the next issue, you see his costume kind of eaten up from the acid bath and everything. And it was a nice attention to detail that I know a lot of people feel that were lacking in some of the 70s work, but here you see they stick right to it. And I also appreciate that it seems like he went through his training served him well, because so many of his traps that he faces now harken back to some trial that he went through back then, relates to his previous story quite nicely. So I guess the training at the Kun Loon is well designed for facing future death traps.
Yep, the adventure he gets is the one he was preparing for sure. Now, this Triple Iron guy is really overpowered, and Iron Fist is kind of frustrating him by being quick and moving out of his way a lot of the time. So, Triple Iron is saying things like, "And now you must stand still and allow me to kill you." And Iron Fist takes him out in the end with a bunch of live wires, whipping them forwards at the guy like lashing serpents, as Doug Munch writes.
Well, don't forget, we have our first appearance of our friend here, the mysterious ninja.
Indeed.
Well, without the mysterious ninja, he wouldn't know to use the wires, so he gets a little bit of supernatural help in this issue.
Also, Iron Fist finally confronts Harold Meacham, who is legless in a wheelchair. He's been going batty waiting the 10 years for Iron Fist to come get him. After leaving Danny and his mother on the ledge, he fell himself, Meacham did, up in those mountains back on that fateful day, and ended up being nursed back to health by a Tibetan farmer, and who unfortunately had to bilaterally amputate his lower extremities. So this farmer guy, while he's recuperating, is visited by a monk that spoke of Kun Loon and a boy taken who was orphaned and his parents died in the mountains and all this. So Meacham knows that Danny has lived and made it to Kun Loon and has a 10-year hourglass, basically, before this guy comes back for him.
And it certainly explains why he was able to get all those traps and all that thing set up in there. And also the reference that Triple Iron makes about having been stuck in the room for 10 years.
And, Iron Fist, he hears this pathetic story and sees this husk of a guy who's driven himself paranoid and spent all this fortune on all these traps and everything trying to keep Iron Fist away. Like you said, it's just not in his character to go through with this revenge thing. He's not going to go to the dark side of the Force, if you will. And he just walks away. He walks away with a tear in his eye appropriate for an Indian looking at litter in the countryside,
The lone tear. Although it looks like the other eye is welling up a little too.
But he's denied Meacham his deserved, and now Meacham even desires his own death, and he doesn't get it. But like you said, all along we've seen these glimpses of Iron Fist being trailed by a ninja. A silent ninja who shows up here and there and, points Iron Fist in the right direction. And here he appears, and after Iron Fist leaves the room, he runs Meacham through with his sword and kills him. So Iron Fist runs back to sea, right? And he ends up getting discovered standing over Meacham's body by Joy Meacham, who is Harold's, quite hot daughter. And she swears she's going to get Iron Fist if it's the last thing she does and sends him packing.
Well, the one note I kind of enjoyed was, so when Iron Fist turns to walk away, Meacham is going to do in Iron Fist. But he pulls out what looks to be one of those, like, German pistols from World War II or something. Yeah. Like, it's a real funky design-looking gun. And I'm like, I guess that's to make him even more of a villain, that he uses, like, a Nazi-style pistol to shoot the guy with. But I like that touch of, like, he's pulling out some old-timey-looking pistol to do, and that's when the ninja jumps in and gets him. Yep. And, of course, then Joy shows up, and she's pretty mad and feels that Iron Fist gets blamed for the murder, and she's going to get him.
Issue 19 starts with Iron Fist leaving the Meacham building, and he's confronted by Colleen Wing, who aids him and brings him to her father, who is a professor of Oriental Studies at Columbia University. And so this is the first appearance of Colleen Wing, one of the Daughters of the Dragon, as we come to know them today. And Professor Wing, he's a kind old fella. He becomes sort of a benefactor father figure to Danny, right? And Danny becomes his bodyguard because there's a cult, the cult of Kari Kai is trying to assassinate poor Professor Wing because the professor has their evil Book of Kali.
And the Professor Wing character is a little bit of a whatever the story needs him to be, which was the only part that got to me.
That's for sure.
Because there's some of the fighting elements that Professor Wing picks up on that seem a little unlikely, and I would have preferred he had a more strictly defined role as the aged professor expert rather than also the fighting expert that he is. But I'm not going to, you know, it doesn't greatly detract from it or anything, but that was the one thing that got me a little bit. Although I'm surprised you didn't remark that the surprisingly attractive Colleen Wing.
Yeah, right.
I'm going to start using that adjective now.
What's funny is Professor Wing, after he had uncovered this Book of Kali in a North Indian archaeological dig, on his way out, he ran across the same monk who told Meacham about Iron Fist and also learns about Iron Fist and Kun Lun. So Wing has also been waiting the 10 years, and that's how he was able to send Colleen to go meet him in front of Meacham's building. He was easy to, compute when he would be there.
I guess it's not such a secret city after all.
Right. Well, this one blabbermouth monk. Now, Iron Fist calls Joy Meacham to try to explain, and she sets up a meeting with him. And, of course, it's a trap. And there's four assassins again, always four. But this time, Iron Fist is aided by the ninja.
Well, and there's a nice, cute little beginning fake-out that I won't spoil, but I did enjoy quite a bit. Because he's in an arcade, so he gets faked out a little.
You can spoil it if you want. This is 40-year-old comics.
Well, he walks in, and he sees, like, a gun being drawn and spins, and gives a crushing ram's head blow, and it turns out it's one of those little arcade dummy things that you're supposed to shoot your light gun at. And I just thought it was a funny little, like, I can see the guy walking in, and then, like a coiled tiger, he just snaps this guy's neck, and it's just a dummy.
Sure.
And then the bad guys jump in, and they have a fun, they make an effort to make the bad guys interesting, because here they have this complicated sequence where they tie up his arms, and one guy leaps over the other one, and kind of a neat, like the action sequence don't all feel just the same six or seven blows. Like, they seem to make a real effort to have different sort of action and different weapons and everything.
There's no action sequence that only lasts a page or two. This is a, you know, six-page action sequence here. It's great stuff, and it keeps the comics moving along. It really is a lot of fun to read, especially in a big chunk like this. Now, issue 20, we're getting... via the cover copy, it's Kung Fu versus the Deadly Art of Savat, and that means Batroc Zilliper.
You know I'm a big fan of Batroc.
So here we've got Iron Fist taking on yet another group of assassins who are after Professor Wing as the issue opens. And then he heads over to the Meacham building. He really did want to plead his innocence to Joy, but she had set that trap for him. And once again, she and her, you know, sneaky Uncle Ward Meacham reveal Batroc the Leaper, who is in waiting. And he attacks with a whop. And like I said, the battle sequences are all multi-page. This is Iron Fist and Batroc sparring here is told over 4 pages. And one of those pages is a 16-panel grid, Andrew.
Oh, and I really like that. And here we get Arvel Jones is introduced. And I wanted to make one other quick comment about these issues. They do a nice job, no more than 2 or 3 panels, where they catch people up. So although reading it in sequence, you're like, yeah, I know he was in the city, and I know the ninja killed him and all that. But I think it's not like you're slogging through pages of it, but it's nice that in each issue they quickly, okay, here's a panel about what you may have missed if you didn't catch it, just to get everyone up to speed. And I think Jones does really nice with the action. Some of the close-ups work, some of the close-ups don't work for me. Yeah. But the 16-panel grid is fun. I mean, it's like that, as we were talking about earlier, it's the attack, counter, parry, attack, counter, parry, that gives you, like, in 16-panel, I mean, think about that in today's comics.
You know what,
that's an issue right there, you know what I mean?
But you also get to see each fighter really show his stuff, too, which is cool. And they're a pretty even match for each other. The confrontation only ends when Iron Fist's Iron Fist meets a leaping Batroc's foot. Oof.
Sacre bleu.
But then in comes Batroc's brigade, a whole army of fighters now to back up Batroc. And Danny holds his own for a while, but again ends up being aided by this mysterious silent ninja who helps him escape after Iron Fist clears a path with his Iron Fist.
And the ninja here, you do got to think that Iron Fist really owes him because he's bailed him out consistently issue after issue here. But he doesn't have a lot of – he doesn't like that the ninja's killing these people.
And issue 20 of Marvel Premiere ends with the ninja appearing over an open book, this Book of Kali, and really withering away or melting into it, and he's replaced by the body of Professor Wing. Huh. What's up with that?
I did not see that coming.
Issue number 21... begins with, I think, a great opening 2-page sequence with Batroc really ticked off that he's not going to be paid by the Meachams. You know, the job was to kill Iron Fist, and he didn't. So they say they don't owe him any money, and Batroc is saying, like, you know, some of my men died fighting that dog of a ninja that fought with Iron Fists. What do I tell their widows, right? Good old Batroc. You know, when Iron Fist returns, and I know what a man of character he seems to be, and he will return, Batroc may well be at his side. And again, that brings me back to what I was saying about Batroc last episode in our big Captain America retrospective, which Batroc is pretty quick to join the side of angels and fight alongside the heroes if his ethics suggest it.
He has his strict code, but my favorite thing about Batroc is, after he yells at him, he doesn't just leave. He always leaves by leaping.
Yeah.
Like you might storm out purposely. That's not Batroc the Leaper. When he leaves, he just jumps. I'm done with you. Boop. And he hops off. It works fine in the comic, but I can't imagine how that would be in like a TV show or whatever. Like,
I'm just bounds out of there. Iron Fist returns back to the Wing's residence to find bodies laying all over the place, and the place is a wreck, totally more than a signs of struggle. There's no sign of the Professor or Colleen Wing. But it's here that Danny first meets Misty Wing, with her afro and her attitude. The Fist and the Mist together for the first time.
And as the caption says, you are somewhat amazed to see that she is a woman. a beautiful woman at that. Dun, dun, dun.
She calls him Zorro, cries bull at him when he tries to explain, and, you know, suggests that she's not some dumb street broad. So she's really packing the attitude right from the beginning. And
Iron Fist does have an unfortunate attitude where it's always shocking when he finds women that can fight, because we're going to point out in the series that in Kun Lun, women aren't allowed to do any fighting. So he does have these kind of antiquated notions, and that puts him also as a bit of a man out of time. And, you know, this is the mid-70s.
Right, and this is the time of, you know, women being on the other side of the bra burning and et cetera. So for sure, it's a culture shock for him. Now, the ninja appears, this time in a visible astral-type form, and floats away, pointing, getting Iron Fist and Misty, I guess it's just a fist, I should say, into the subway tunnels, into a secret temple of Kali that exists, in the subterranean tunnels. And this temple of Kali is where this cult of Kari Kai worship. And there's a huge idol there, and Colleen and Professor Wing are chained to it. And there's plenty of assassins around for Iron Fist to have to wade through, including a couple of females, the living goddesses, who have mystical weapons, a cloak of darkness and nunchucks with the power of the sun.
And I thought... Again, while I really enjoy these issues, and also you'll see another trope here where in his battle his costume gets somewhat destroyed. He must have packed about 20 of these things when he left Kun Lun. But I thought the ninja leading him there was kind of weak. Like, they could have, I don't know, he could have followed a trail or something, or maybe one of them could have knocked something. Like, it just seemed like a strange, the ninja to do some mystical power we've never seen him have before. Right. Just to get him to the sub. It just seemed like they could have... That was the one thing I would change, is they could have found another way to get him to the subway, in my opinion. But I still enjoy the issue, but that was just the one story point where I'm like, really?
What's funny is that they try to explain it in the next issue when Len Wein is writing... Len's the editor at that point. And there's a little caption box that says that the ninja was unable to possess... Professor Wing and turn into, you know, and make him become the ninja and escape and go get Iron Fist or whatever, because the professor is chained in iron, and something about iron not being able, like the ninja not being able to, you know, manifest with iron around it or something like that. There was some kind of comment along those lines, but they tried to explain it, so even then they realized there was something tricky.
And there is some history of that. Traditionally, it's actually more, I believe, in the English fairies
right.
are supposed to have dread of iron, and iron is supposed to be an effective counter to them and their magic. But, it just didn't feel. Although what does work for me really well is when the Cloak of Darkness is invoked, it allows, you know, everything's done in kind of black with shades and... different, and then the nunchucks of the sun and everything, and I thought those pages were particularly effective as a different style output, because he can't really see anything, but they're not just going to have totally black panels, so I thought it was fun.
The hard thing, though, for me is knowing that this issue happened to be inked by Vinnie Coletta, that there may have been more detail in those backgrounds or even more people in those panels that he may have taken a liberty to just totally black out. But I will give Mr. Coletta his due shortly, because he will really deserve it in a few issues. We've got, you know, this him fighting all these this group of cultists here, and they end up all escaping, and Colleen gets to show that she has fighting skills herself, so now here's the second woman that Iron Fist is encountering with fighting skills, and she and Iron Fist actually see the professor turn into the ninja here, so that part of the mystery is really peaked. And in a moment of that was too fast to prevent happening, a cultist drops the Book of Kali into a bunch of flames, and it gets destroyed. And this separates physically the professor and the ninja. the ninja's stunned. He was under the impression that he would die if the book was destroyed. And, you know, he was imprisoned in this book by Kunlun a long time ago, and now he's really ticked off. He's been protecting his own prison by trying to protect this book from being destroyed. So he turns on Iron Fist as the issue closes, as a way of getting revenge upon the city itself.
And as they say, we promise to explain all this honest in the teaser for the next issue. And the cover to 22, I think, is lots of fun. Again, it's your four people being attacking Iron Fist, but it's just there's a lot going on. He's hitting three guys at once, and the ninja's behind him, although the ninja, for some reason, has red and purple, unlike his normal all purple. But still, it's a great cover.
Yep. Different colorist for the covers. I think in the 70s it was George Russos, who used to be George Bell, the old art penciler and inker, who was coloring Marvel's covers, if I'm not mistaken.
And we did those, I remember that, certainly Bell from, I think, those Cap issues.
Right. He did some inks over Kirby for sure, and some of the early Fantastic Four stuff as well. Issue 22 is, you know, the battle going on between the ninja and Iron Fist. It goes on for a few pages, and the cult assassins and the police enter the fray, and it just becomes totally chaotic. In the midst of all this, the ninja confesses to the crime of Harold Meacham in front of the cops, which clears Iron Fist of that murder. But then he teleports the ninja and Iron Fist away to like a mystical, gravity-free dimensional space of his own design. And the fight here takes place over seven pages, Andrew. One of these pages has nine panels. Another has 12 panels. There's so much sparring packed into these pages.
And the backgrounds are reminiscent of our, similar to our, not quite as nice, but similar to the Doctor Strange Ditko sort of weird dimensions that I love so much, with different planes of angles and weird tendrily things spinning off in the distance in different colors.
And along the way, there's three pages that reveal the ninja's origin, which is kind of a fun little diversion. He was the greatest of the samurai. He was forced to leave his samurai order due to, well, let's say, excess cruelty. And he meets Master Khan, a mystic, who steers him into becoming a ninja while also teaching him mystical arts. So where a ninja might just seem like he's magical, this one actually is. This Master Khan guy wants Kunlun destroyed, so he sent the ninja there. He took on the city's fighters, and if it wasn't for Li Kung the Thunderer, he would have been successful, but Li Kung defeated him. So Yuti, the august personage in Jade, oh, I did it again, banishes the ninja to the prison of this Book of Kali, which eventually gets buried until Professor Wing excavates it. And in the end of their battle, the Fist and the ninja, Iron Fist puts all his chi into the Iron Fist, and the ninja puts all of his essence into his sword, making it glow red, and they connect, and Iron Fist ends up the final victor.
And there's some fun moments. Iron Fist, as we've seen before, plays possum. And so the ninja, I like where he's like, bah, I prattle on, and like has to explain why he was monologuing.
Yeah.
So they recognize that, why would this guy do this? Oh, let's give him a motivation. So I like that. And the other part I like is when the Iron Fist has his shirt ripped again, and so he just tears it off. Like some, like, now I mean, bit like,
yep.
Enough of this. He just, you know, grabs it, rips it off, throws it down, and then you're now it's serious. When you rip the shirt off,
yep.
You're like, all bets are off. And then it ends at a nice moment. And the Arvel Jones stuff really reminded me of the early 80s explosion of sort of indie artwork for me. I don't know if it's other stuff he worked on or whatever, but that last panel looked right out of a whole bunch of random black and white books I used to buy in the early 80s, but no specific titles leap to mind, but just that kind of his perspective or something about it really was reminiscent for me of that era.
Yeah, A. Bradford does the inks over Jones on this issue and really does them a lot more service than Coletta did. Again, Coletta was the guy that Marvel used to go to when they needed a book done overnight. So, you know, you never know what kind of – you got to give it that caveat that you never know what kind of a situation Coletta was put into since he was the go-to guy for situations like that. So you can't all put it on that guy's artistic vision, but this issue just makes Jones look a heck of a lot better from the anatomy on.
Right. The only thing about Jones is sometimes the perspective seems a little strange. Like, that's the one thing that... And I guess that's what reminds me of the early 80s, is so many of those books had kind of a weird perspective to them. I'm not an art critic. But I kind of like it, because, like I said, it just reminds me of that time and a lot of different random books I was reading that would appear one week and be gone the next.
That's the 8-issue origin story of Iron Fist. Danny's now left trapped on Earth for 9 more years until he can return to Kunlun, and everything about our world, he says, reminds him of his now meaningless 10-year investment in revenge. So this is where he's left. And issue 23, it's here that Chris Claremont takes over writing the Fist and handles his solo stories for the next 18 issues. Really a new beginning for the character in every kind of a way. And the art team here of Pat Broderick and Bob McLeod inks is really nice to see.
And he also has the added burden of proving his innocence to Joy Meacham, because he understands the detriment of being consumed by revenge, so he feels a real obligation to make sure that she understands that he had nothing to do with anything. Because although the guy admitted to the police, I think there's still some question about how that's going to go over with Joy. Although right. I don't know that Joy shows up again, does she? Or is that
no?
In the
but
next
she right exactly. But okay. Yeah, she's a little too emotional to accept, you know, hard facts at this point in her grief cycle.
Well, some magical ninja whose body vanishes when he's killed. I can see how that might not give you the sense of closure you're expecting.
Now, here we also have Danny focusing on being Danny Rand for the first time. He literally takes a walk in the park with Colleen Wing without his Iron Fist garb, which we're really seeing him for the first time other than the Kunlun sequences, walking around without his mask on. Unfortunately, there is a sniper shooting spree in the park. Danny saves a kid, then faces off against a sort of silver-plated skinned fella named Warhawk, who Chris Claremont would again use in his Black Goliath series in Black Goliath number 3, and then in X-Men number 110, which was the Tony DeZuniga fill-in issue. And then Warhawk would next come back in Power Man Iron Fist 76. So he would stay a Claremont character and then come back to being a Iron Fist nemesis eventually. But anyway, this Warhawk guy, he proves too tough, literally too tough for Danny. Danny gets knocked unconscious, and Colleen gets kidnapped by him, and he's on like a war flashback, repressed memory trip.
That was a popular storyline from back in the day, people trapped in the cycle of where they were. But what I enjoyed about this was you don't really get that much about Warhawk. Like, he's kept very mysterious about his powers and sort of really where he... I mean, you get a little bit of feeling, okay, something was done to him in the military. He was obviously in Vietnam, but you don't really get the full explanation like we do with the ninja or some of the other characters. He's just this sort of mysterious, tragic figure.
Yeah, it's cool that Claremont kept using him, though, and even in his big X-Men run. So Danny wakes up from being knocked out by Professor Wing, and he gets introduced along with all of us for the first time to Lieutenant Rafe Scarf, NYPD. And this guy would be around right through the Power Man Iron Fist series until the end there. He fills Danny in on who Warhawk is, and Iron Fist suits up and heads out to take him down.
You ever notice, I thought that Scarfetti looked a bit like Meacham, too, with the sort of Tom Selleck mustache and everything, but
was the 70s.
That's the mid-70s.
Yeah, right, exactly. And Danny equates his effort to recover Colleen to a past challenge in Kunlun, where he had to scale a alpine cliff face to recover his stolen locket that had his mother's picture in it. And there ends up being a four-page melee with Warbird and or Warhawk, I should say. And Iron Fist does the Iron Fist right to Warhawk's abdomen, which is a pretty tough shot, but I guess Warhawk can take it. But it sends Warhawk through the wall and out and into the drink. They're like on the docks of the East River or something.
And Iron Fist is pretty tore up because he tries to save him. And through another flashback, Warhawk declines to be saved. And then he's just left questioning, you know, what went on. And then we go to issue 24, who has another striking cover for you, versus the Monstroid.
Yeah, these Gil Kane covers are great. And the art in this issue, beautiful art. I mean, props to both Pat Broderick, the penciler, and Vinnie Coletta. Yes, Vinnie Coletta over Pat Broderick. The splash page on issue 170 of this volume, Iron Fist's back 2 pages later on 172. The seaman's face in 176. There's Iron Fist punching the robot face apart on issue 186, and Danny at bat at a softball game on 179, where you can the texture of the clothes and the seams, and I don't know if Coletta was trying to balance out some cosmic karma here from that other issue, but this is some of the nicest inking I've seen from Coletta ever in his career.
Yeah, and in those opening scenes, you can even see like the sweat pouring off of them as they're fighting, and just like you say, those littler details that maybe in other instances might have been omitted or erased, he made an effort to make sure stayed with the artwork.
The issue opens with this wonderful splash of Iron Fist in a cool pose, and then a four-page sequence of Iron Fist sparring with Colleen Wing. And she's tough. He's not used to it, given Kunlun's culture, as we said before. And they end up taking another walk in the park, or he does, I should say, since the last walk in the park went so well. And he gets roped into a softball game with Lieutenant Scarf and his friends that he just happened upon. But this robot, monstrous Monstroid attacks, and we get 5 pages of Kung Fu versus robot. It's like two bad dance styles against each other.
Well, I also like how the robot's optical centers are placed just like eyes, so you can take them out. Like, you'd think we could just place them wherever. But anyways, it's a fun, and the police can't do any good, and they point that out, how, you know, like 5 guys with guns can't do anything, but one man with a metal pipe is going to...
And, you know, binocular vision is pretty well evolved. I mean, sometimes the biological is the epitome already that the robotic should be trying to mimic.
That could be, but I just thought it was funny that the placement, right in a head.
You
would think for more protection. Likewise, I would put the processing center in the chest rather than in the head, because the chest can be more fully armored. In a sense, you know what I mean? You can put thicker plating there.
Of course.
It's nice to see the Iron Fist done in thermal, because, you know, the eyes are destroyed, so you get to see how the icy calm, and then he forces his chi into his hand.
I certainly don't want to face off against your killer robot if you ever construct one. It sounds like you've put a little thought into a good design.
To steal a line from Mr. Burns, and those guys at Radio Shack said I was mad.
They called me mad at the Academy. The last page of this issue gives us Master Khan. He's watching from a distance, and he's revealed as the mastermind behind the Monstroid, and vows that Iron Fist will either serve him like a dog, or he will die.
Oh, and I do like the little three-quarter splash page when Iron Fist punches through the robot's head,
and all
the pieces go flying and everything.
That's one of the panels that I mean that Coletta just nailed on the inking. I mean, he really could have taken some liberties on that panel, and we would have never noticed the difference, but the chunks flying out, and it is really cool looking. Really cool. the face, really nicely done. Now, the next issue, issue 25, is the last issue of the Marvel Premiere run of Iron Fist, and it is particularly notable because it brings John Byrne on board, and he'd be on board for the next 16 solo Iron Fist issues, the entire 15-issue series, and this last issue of Marvel Premiere, although Marvel Premiere continued on with Hercules stories after this. Iron Fist returns home, and he finds Professor Wing acting like psychotic and violent, and he has to take him out, actually. And he and Lieutenant Scarf out front witness Colleen's abduction, the poor thing's always being abducted, and they pursue in Scarf's police vehicle until reality starts going crazy, and Scarf crashes the automobile.
Well, they have to avoid the there's a bunch of school kiddies in the yard that they have to be careful. But when he goes crazy, my favorite is that they have his hands on the steering wheel, and in the panel, the steering wheel turns into a dragon's head, which was like a very cool looking image.
And he's holding the jaws apart with his hands instead of holding onto the wheel up. Totally neat. So what's going on here? Iron Fist pulls Scarf out of the burning, turned over vehicle, but he starts having wild hallucinations too. Hallucinations of his dad, and it doesn't make any sense, but it turns out it's Angar the Screamer, the two-bit Daredevil villain, who I think was premiered in Daredevil 100, I want to say.
And he's definitely from the Age of Aquarius.
Indeed.
From his outfit and design.
I remember when I first got the first official handbook of the Marvel Universe when it first came out, and flipping through every entry and reading every entry in there, and it's like, who the heck is this Angar guy? I had forgotten about the Daredevil appearance before that, but like, this guy, what a nut!
And when he invokes the scream, though, they do this kind of interesting technique because it happens again there where Iron Fist is done regular art and color, and then the other colors are kind of a lighter pastel kind of, I don't know what you'd call the effect, but I thought it worked pretty cool and made Angar not so silly looking after all.
Yeah, really, really coolly done. And, to make a long story short, since, it doesn't really add anything to Iron Fist's mythology or origin as a character or anything, Iron Fist ultimately takes down Angar, and Scarf uncovers Angar's Stark International ID card, like an employee card. So that's where this series ends, and the Iron Fist number one issue shows us right on the cover that we're going to get Iron Fist versus Iron Man.
A duel of iron. I think I'm going to generally probably think Iron Man might have the advantage in that instance.
And he does. Iron Fist here infiltrates Stark International. He encounters Misty Knight there, who's kind of dressed up like a superhero to some extent. But
it looked like an X-Men outfit. I was like, really? With the yellow and the blue? And
What was bad, though, is the horrible blue eyeshadow they put on her. That went all the way up to her eyebrows and really doesn't go well with, how black hair is colored in the comics as blue.
Right.
So, Misty's got a big blue afro and big blue eyeshadow, and it just looks terrible against her, complexion.
And the giant MK belt buckle seemed a little...
Yeah. It's like, Moon Knight? But as we said, Iron Fist faces Iron Man. You can't break into Stark International without Iron Man coming to the scene. And Iron Fist even gets to give Iron Man an Iron Fist to the chest. But Misty outs a criminal traitor that's working for Stark that had been presumed dead and all this other side stuff that was going on. They end up friends in the end. And one thing that I think is really unfortunate here, it not only is the inker on Byrne here a little bit unfortunate, Al McWilliams, but it's also the time where there was an editorial mandate that Iron Man has to have a nose. And I think it really it really looks terrible.
He looks like one of the Metal Men to me from the Distinguished Competition. I don't know if you read any of those.
Sure.
You know, like Tan and Copper and those guys. That's what it looks like to me. The thing also is they make it very clear that the showdown happens in a place with all these explosive canisters and everything, so that it more evens the match between the two. Because obviously I think most people would think Iron Man would be pretty well. He could just stand far away and blast him with repulsor rays instead of engaging him in the hand-to-hand that us Iron Fist fans want to see.
The issue ends with Iron Fist's hand and Iron Man's ironclad hand shaking hands in a full panel. There is a bit of a Steel Serpent subplot that's developing, too, of someone connected to Kunlun, who has a similar but incomplete tattoo on his chest that Iron Fist does. And that all develops throughout the Iron Fist series and doesn't get wrapped up there. It gets wrapped up in those two issues of Marvel Team-Up from the late 70s. What did I say those were? 63 and 64 of Marvel Team-Up.
And we do see Colleen Wing putting up a bit of a fight. So she's the damsel in distress, but she's no pushover, I'll have you know.
In the last issue of this Masterworks edition, we have Iron Fist issue number 2. And Iron Fist, the issue opens with him at Professor Wing's hospital bedside. And he's thinking of Kunlun and a time he got jumped by a jealous rival and this rival's gang. And he ends up being saved by a masked fighter that ends up being revealed accidentally to be a girl. And that's forbidden, as we've said, right? And she's going to be mind-wiped along with her lover who trained her in the martial arts. And they're both friends of Danny's, and they end up letting him know that they're going to flee.
And Danny is led to believe, and whether this is true or not, I'll leave it to the imagination of the readers, that you can't leave the city. If you go past the valley in the safe environs, it's instant death outside. I mean, except every 10 years when the forces align.
And unfortunately, we're going to find out why, because Iron Fist pursues this couple when they make their escape from Kunlun. And he encounters the Hill Three. And the Hill Three are plant-like creatures that are the personification of the intelligent vegetation that surrounds Kunlun. The landscape itself, if you will, that Kunlun rests for 9 years out of a decade. And they're sworn enemies of Kunlun, which doesn't make for a welcoming environment for this fugitive couple. And Danny comes upon them. They are trapped in pods where they're going to be drained and consumed by the Hill Three. And Iron Fist is going to be next.
And he uses his powers. We also get a little teaser that there's more to Misty Knight. This is, again, one of those things I love about it's a little hint of something to come in the future, just a little teaser about her. But, yeah, he's able to escape, but we get another sequence where the woman calls him brother. But he is not able to rescue those two, and somehow he escapes and gets back to Kunlun, but he's not able to rescue them.
Right.
And he doesn't remember what happened. He just remembers her calling him brother and then fading out. And like I said, I just like those weird little threads that they leave for future.
And this informs the current continuity for him at this time in that, you know, he couldn't save his friends. So he now really must go out of his way to make sure that he does save Colleen because he let this one go, you know. And like you said, let's look quick for our last bit to analyze here is the two-page subplot sequence that you refer to. It's Misty and Lieutenant Scarf talking, and he refers to her days as his partner on the force, right? And that she was a good cop, one of the best, he says. And she says something to the effect of, like, that's when I was a whole woman, and I'm not anymore, and that's going to be the end of it. And while she's saying that, she's simultaneously crushing the edge of what looks like some type of stone surface in her right hand, which we're getting the first allusion to that she's got a bionic arm.
And the other thing is, for those of you that like me that obviously are familiar with the Byrne, Claremont, X-Men run or whatever, this is just right. The same feel, art, totally. Like if you like that stuff, this is something you should check out, because to me, it felt very much the same animal. So if you'd like that, now maybe you just like those characters or whatever, but if you like that, how the stories were told, the sort of method and art and everything, I would completely recommend it. To me, it felt like this could have been some issue of the X-Men as well, you know?
And one of these days, I'm going to go through those issues, probably a little not as plot-heavy since they've been read and they're so much more available than this material is. But that whole Uncanny X-Men run, Alan, New Mutant, once said to me when I first started doing these segments that I'm creating a tour guide experience through the Marvel U for my kids someday if they want to do so. So I don't want to avoid some of the obvious ones too, because they'll need a finger pointed in that direction as well, and what was so fun about it. Of course it is to us, you know.
they'll need the this is graduate level. They'll need the 101 level, you know, the primer and the basics, and then they'll get. But I just, for those of you that have a fondness for that era, and maybe you just didn't, because as you point out, the series only lasted 15 issues or something like that, right. So it's not like it easily could have missed your radar, and I was unaware of this particular run. I just was familiar with the Iron Fist character. I saw this in the store and was like, yoinks, that's going to be mine. Picked it up spontaneously because I enjoy this era. And then I found it, and now reading it, I'm like, this is totally just like those old X-Men I remember, which I've read a million times. So if you like that stuff, try this stuff out.
And the third in the trifecta is Claremont and Byrne's Marvel team-up issues from this time period as well. There was about 10 issues of Marvel team-up or so that they did together just before the X-Men stuff, or at the very beginning of the X-Men stuff, that were just fantastic too. Their take on Spider-Man and the other characters around the Marvel Universe are great, and that also led them to be able to finish up this stuff.
And that Marvel team-up in general, that's one I've also started grabbing, because for me, that really is. I love that series. That really was a lot of fun. And because it didn't get bogged down so much in a ton of ongoing continuity, I mean, it had threads it picked up and dropped, but it was really just something you could grab at any time and be transported to a fun adventure. And I kind of would like to see a few more titles of that ilk now, but I guess they probably wouldn't survive. It seems like you need to be kind of ground into the main continuity to survive in mainstream comics nowadays.
And it was so special when there was a multi-issue arc in Marvel Team-Up, too. That was really cool, you know, how they would throw a few different characters in there to make it so that it wasn't, Spider-Man and Nick Fury for three issues, you know. But when there was multi-issue things, the time travel stuff, there was a Black Widow and Daredevil-related one, and then this with the Daughters of the Dragon and Iron Fist. I really dug that. Fun comics. All right, thanks, Andrew. We did it. We made it through Marvel Masterworks Volume 1 of Iron Fist.
And we need you people to go out there and buy these so we can make sure we get to Volume 2.
Absolutely.
We don't want to leave our shelves empty.
We've got some cool stuff on tap for future segments, even though summertime distractions are reaching a peak for me right now. In September, we're going to have a three-way Rakers Dozen with both our friend here, Andrew, and Dave Kay. So look forward to that. And before that, I've got a few vacations coming up. I'll try not to miss an episode if I can help it. And we've got some of the Leighton Hercules on tap, too. I've got to nail down a time with the aforementioned Alan New Mutant to record.
I'll look forward to listening to those, for sure.
Thanks for coming back. I appreciate it. I really thought of our earlier conversations, especially the Captain America one, while we were having our Cap Talk last week. It was fun to remember what was one of my favorite segments there with you, as they often are by the time we're done. So thanks.
And thanks for everyone who managed to hang through our long recollection. But like I said, these are, you might have overlooked them, but they're kind of fun if you get a chance to look at them. I think you're going to find they're worth it.
Alright, gang, until Iron Fist upgrades to an iron appendage so he can arm wrestle with Misty, make mine Marvel. Later.
I hope you all enjoyed everything that the guys sent in, and I, as always, I appreciate it. I have been a little busy, and some of that busy has also included reading some comics, and most of them did really good. I do want to touch on, I want to, again, I mean, I will recommend this on every podcast I can. Daredevil. First issue was stunning. It was gorgeous. You had it was two stories. You had the main story kicking off this new, I guess it's the soft reboot. So you get a feel for what you can probably expect with this new iteration. Mark Waid, great job doing the writing on this. The art in the first story is by Paulo Rivera, and it's, like I said, it's gorgeous. The way he draws Spot, I've gone on about it in the past. The backup story, Marcos Martin and his little, I guess, his tricks with double page spreads and people walking, and he did it. I think he did it in Amazing Spider-Man Annual that had Captain America in it. But second issue, there's no. It wasn't a fluke. The first issue, everybody knew what they were doing. It looks like. I'm guessing the artists are going to swap arcs. Second issue is strictly Rivera as well as a Rivera on inks, but it picks up right where the first issue leaves off, and then you have Daredevil playing detective a little bit. Moves the story along nicely. There's some foggy, I guess, action. We'll say, or some follow-up after some foggy action. But nice to see. Been a while since, I remember when Nelson and Murdoch had their law offices, and I want to say it was Foggy's maybe stepmother who was involved. Either she was a partner, or she was maybe a silent partner, but I remember, we did get quite a bit of backstory. We had some foggy characterization in the past, so this isn't, as long as I've been reading Daredevil, it hasn't just been the Matt Murdock show. You know, he's had a supporting cast, he's had the people that he's had close to him, and looks like we're going to have some more of that with Foggy getting, I don't want to say fleshed out, because it's not like it's a new character, but Foggy's going to have a life, it seems, and hopefully it just won't be like, one page per issue where, we kind of get clued in as to what he's been doing. There'll be some progression and we'll get some more. But the end of the second issue, again, leaving me off with a, oh my gosh, I need the next issue now. I need to find out where this is going. It does make sense after I realized the bad guy that appears at the end of the second issue, and if you see the cover of the third issue, you know what I'm talking about, but the bad guy that makes the appearance, and again, it makes sense as to why Matt is having trouble getting a read on this particular person, in quotes, air quotes, but it makes sense as to why this bad guy would be in Daredevil, considering the character that took over Daredevil's old title. But according to the letters page in the second issue, the third issue wraps up this first arc. So possibly, I haven't checked my previews, possibly the fourth issue may have art by Marcos Martin. So like I said, maybe they're swapping arcs, which is cool. They have a very complementary style. They work well together. It will be almost seamless to see one issue to the next. It's not going to be like as if Chris Omni did an issue and then you're followed up by like Klaus Janson, say, for example. So, Daredevil, get it, read it. You really won't be disappointed. I am I'm a fan again. I'm happy to be reading Daredevil again, and I haven't said that in quite some time. Enjoying the heck out of Fear Itself. This is one thing I'm really along for the ride for. I'm not digging. I'm not really taking notes. I'm really happy with it. I mean, there's some things where Fraction's writing, the way he handles some of the characters might seem a little off, but the art more than makes up for it. And I guess I'm hoping that there is a death in the third issue. I'm telling you now, there's a death in the third issue. If you do not know who this is, you might want to skip ahead a little bit. But this character's death, a lot of people are really put off by it. And by a lot of people, saying that people either on our forum or on Twitter. But I guess that they just wanted something more. They wanted a big to do. If this character has to die, then it has to be grand, and it just, it shouldn't not have been this way, I'm having trouble getting my head around that. I get that, hey, we all want to go out in a blaze of glory. Well, superheroes, maybe, should go out in a blaze of glory, but that's not always the case, and this is a you have gods coming down and battling humans. This is a pretty big to do. The Asgardians are, we'll call them Asgardians, but they're trying to, I guess, reclaim what's theirs, we'll say, and or what they say is theirs. But it seems to be pretty senseless. Most wars, I guess, the casualties in a war are senseless. Not everybody gets to go out in a blaze of glory. And this character in Fear Itself number 3, who was killed, went out fighting. So, as a warrior, it was a good death, I guess, as Thor would say. It's not like he went in his sleep. It's not like he tripped down the stairs and broke his neck. He went out fighting. And I guess people are upset because this character was brought back and was made into something good, and they enjoyed reading this character month in, month out, and now they're upset that he's gone, and I absolutely get that. Holy crap, you don't know how upsetting it is when you lose a character that you are very, very fond of. I mean, I lost Hal Jordan. I lost... There are characters who you want to keep reading, and that's understandable, trust me. But as far as being upset because you don't like the way this character died, It was in a war. That's it's like it's okay that you are upset, but I mean the whole it sucked the way he died. Well, yeah. I just it's weird, and I'm getting off track because I just wanted to really run down a few of the things I've been reading, but I'm just trying to understand why people are so upset over this character's death or because of how he died, and I get it. I just it's somewhat fitting in this regard. I don't want to see the character go away, but I mean he went in battle and someone bested him, and it sucks that he's dead, but it was a senseless death, but that's what happens in war. And that's what I'll say about that. So I'm trying not to name any names, but if you check out the November solicits, you will see Fear Itself 7.1. There's going to be three of the issues, 7.1, 2, and 3, each featuring Marvel's trinity of Captain America, Steve Rogers, and Iron Man and Thor. So there is a in the Captain America special, I guess it ties into this character's death. But I was more of a oh no to I was really just I was quite taken aback by something that happened at the end of the fifth issue involving Captain America. That's all I'll say about that for now. That really took me aside. Actually, there's the action, there's the incident involving the symbol, but then there's something that I never really would have expected Steve Rogers to say. So the fifth issue I felt is probably the biggest when it comes to holy crap moments so far in the series. Like I said, the third issue, yeah, it was pretty big with that death, but there's been other things going on where the death kind of, I guess, is getting overshadowed a bit. And maybe that's not fair either. Maybe that's why some people could be getting upset. But in any case, there's also, there is X-Men Schism, which first issue you had pencils by Carlos Pacheco. And actually, I will, while I'm telling you about the series, I'm going to find out real quick because I don't want to neglect anyone. The first issue, thank you, Carlos Pacheco and Cam Smith did the art. Second issue is Pencils and Inks by Frank Cho. Third issue has art by Daniel Acuna, and that's fine. See, if you can't say anything nice, so I'm just trying to behave myself. I am enjoying Chase and Aaron's story. The art on the first issue, good stuff. Art on the second, great stuff. I really like Frank Cho's Logan / Wolverine. Of course, drawing the women as good as Frank Cho does. They really look like they're supposed to look. And then you have Scott Summers, Scott Slim Summers. And I guess he was a little on the slim side for some people. I guess all that was missing was a pop collar and a sweater wrapped around his neck and getting ready to go play a couple of rounds of tennis. This Scott was slim, and I love that it was is reminiscent to the Paul Smith days. I had no problem with it. The Daniel Acuna art, I found it to be dark. It was dark. It was muddy. The outside took place at night, but even with gunfire going on and a lot of popping, and there should have been more light, I think, going on than there was. It was very hard for me to tell who was supposed to be who. At the end of the second issue, you have characters wearing the old Hellfire Club soldier garb, and in the third issue, if it wasn't for Miss Pigtails, I wouldn't know. Although, granted, the word balloons helped. Being able to say who was saying what, that huge, is a great big benefit. And that was helped because the way Jason Aaron paced the story is that before, the third issue takes place for the most part at a museum of the Celebrate Mutants, Mutant History, things like that. And we cut away from the control room in Utopia, and we go back to months ago where we see this new Hellfire, or the those that are going to control the Hellfire Club, we see them in a meeting. And, you know, we're told months ago. And then we cut to now with in the museum. And, but because of that months ago page where everybody has a little thing where they get to say about, you know, who they are, a little introduction going around the table, it helped when it came time to read the story when the Hellfire Club was attacking the mutants. And like I said, big ups to Jason Aaron for that. This was one case where the story definitely helped the art. I going to try to be very, very nice, and I don't want to disparage or be mean about it, so I'm just going to stop. But Scott really isn't holding anything back when it comes to making his stance known on the I'm going to be a prick scale. I was a little surprised at his actions in this third issue. But then he tells Logan one thing, and it makes it, I don't think it makes Scott right, but I don't see Scott as one to place blame and point fingers, but what he told Logan, I felt made sense. In that case, it works, and I guess Scott isn't entirely to blame. Entirely. I'm not saying he's right in any sense, but he's not alone there. I don't know I guess we know where the X-Men are going once Schism is done, but I am enjoying the journey in this case. I'm not worried about the destination. Again, kind of just like Fear itself, I don't know where things are going, because I'm trying to avoid solicits and things like that. I really have scaled back on checking out preview pages, so I am just, right now, it's all about the journey for me. I have rambled on and probably made very few points that I wanted to make earlier. So I'm going to leave a couple of things for next time. So I have to go back and read. I'm going to start the second issue of Captain America once I'm done with this. And I also have been, I decided to, actually no, I'll talk about that later, but 206-312-5239 if you want to leave a voicemail. MarvelNoise.com is the website. You can hit the forum at bullpenbulletinspodcast.com/forum. You can listen to me talk with Jason and Chris and Vince on 11 o'clock comics, and check out the other shows on the Comic Book Noise / Deliberate Noise Network. I'm done. I'm out of here. Have a great week, everybody. Thanks again to everybody for helping out with this episode. You got Pat, you got Rick, and the Colonel. You've got Andrew. You've got, of course, Steve. So thanks, guys, and kudos to you all. We'll be back soon. Take care, buddy. Bye-bye.